Hello and welcome to our Insulin Resistance Solution Practitioner Training. This is our Rounds 2 call. This is a call where we get to connect and you get to ask me questions and I get to share with you how to proceed with working with your clients with insulin resistance. This is our second call, and last week we went over a lot of the intro stuff and the ways for you to get started, plus we went over a very, very critical aspect of working with somebody with insulin resistance or blood sugar imbalances in general, and that is glucose testing. And I went through in detail how to test your patients, your clients, or teach them how to test themselves. And I gave you access to part one on the site, which had about a 12-step process for getting started. You may have made it through all of it or part of it. It's okay. You can take this at your own pace. I understand that everybody's going to take it at their own pace. That I would hope that by now all of you have at least ordered or purchased a blood glucose meter. And it would be really cool if you started to test it yourself, test your own. So go ahead and raise your hand, star two, if you have purchased a blood sugar meter or own a blood sugar meter. And on the web, just go ahead and type in, hey, I have, you know, whether you have purchased it, and if you have purchased it, if you've gone ahead and started testing yourself. So it looks like most people have gotten it. It's about 75% of you. I'm going to put your hands down, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hand if you started testing yourself. All right. We have a couple. So I'm just going to take one or two shares just to give me an idea of how the experience of testing yourself is going and if you're starting to feel comfortable with actually teaching this to someone. And if you haven't raised your hand, I'm going to just call on you. Just raise your hand and share why, or I'll just call on somebody and just want to get a sense of what's holding you back. And it may be just that your life's busy or whatever. So let's see. Let's have Deborah share. Deborah Nelson. Hi.
Hi.
So how's the blood sugar testing going for you?
I've just really started again. I did it on the previous program, and I know that it was time for me to get back in and start doing it again.
Good.
So I'm not very fond of it.
A lot of people aren't, and you're going to hear that. And it's actually good if you're not fond of it, because then you're going to be a little bit more sympathetic with the clients you're working with who aren't, and you'll be able to help them through and help them to see the value in it. I don't mind it at all, and I probably do it, 10 or 20 times a day, and it doesn't bother me. So it's hard for me to relate to that anymore. At first it did. So do you feel comfortable teaching people how to do it with the materials that you have so far?
Yes, I do.
Great. Thank you. Let's take one more. Let's take Casey.
Hello. I have not bought one. I don't know why, other than I haven't read any of the materials for the course, and I have not prioritized purchasing one. So it would be a good thing for me to have, I know, but I haven't chosen to buy it yet.
Okay. So are you willing to make a commitment to at least go to your local Walgreens or CVS and start looking at them and considering a purchase?
What I'd rather is you tell me, and somewhere in an email, not where I have to go onto a website or something, just say, here's the one to buy. I will go buy it.
I've already put it up there, and that's a whole lot of extra work for me to create a whole nother email. And it's there, and it's really easy to find on the site. Just click into part one and click on where it says glucose resources. And it lists the one to buy. It even has a link if you wanted to buy it on Amazon. But I can't commit to sending out another email that says, here's the one to buy, because there's words and it's extra work, and then I have to get my team involved to set up the email and have it go out. So I would prefer that you go in and just click on where it says glucose resources. It's really easy. It's set up for you.
Do you know the answer off the top of your head? Because if you know the answer
off
the top
I can tell you
off the top of your head,
I will make
a note right
this second. Absolutely. Yeah, the one I like is the True2Go.
True,
and you can buy it at Walgreens.
true to the number two, go.
Okay, and the other T-R-U-E, and then the number two, and then the word go, okay.
Yeah, that's the one I use the most. There's another one that uses the same strips, and it's called True Test.
Well, which one do you want me to get?
Either one. Some, you know, maybe the store doesn't have the True to Go, and they have the True Test. True Result. True Test is the name of the strips, and they both use the same. The reason we chose this one is because those strips are really easy to get on Amazon, and they're the most economical.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay, good.
True to
yeah,
go or I, true results for those of you. Okay?
True to go or true results, and they use True Test strips. Do they come with any strips?
They come with 10.
Okay.
They often come with a coupon that you can then redeem for a full refund. So you pay $10, you get your $10 back, you have 10 free strips, and then you have to pay for the strips. So it's a really no-brainer from a financial investment standpoint. It makes it easy for
strips too. How many strips will I need?
You know, it depends. If you're going to start really testing regularly, you're going to need at least 100. But we order about 400 at a time, and it lasts us for several months. At the beginning, you're using it more. You're testing more.
Okay.
And I have the like guidelines in that module of exactly when to test and how. And even last week, I went over a little bit of that.
Okay.
Yeah, so I would go to Amazon and order at least 100. It's about $23. I usually just slap down $100 and buy four of them, and then I'm good to go for a long time. And for us, it's my husband and I both use them because I've got him addicted to it. He was, talk about Deborah, right, the little I don't like it too much. My husband was freaked out when I said, I can't do it. You've got to do it for me. I mean, you'd think that I just hit him over the head with a sledgehammer the way he screamed. And so I did that for him the first few times. I said, okay, I guided him through doing it himself. Now he just does it all the time. And he's like, oh, I tested my blood sugar. I ate a grapefruit, and this is what happened. Oh, and I ate this, and this is what happened. Because it's really empowering. And he's not the only one that I see that with. I see that with a lot of people. They're the most resistant, and then when they do it, they become addicted to it. Not all the time. There's still some people who are reticent about it, but a lot of folks get that way. They're just like, wow, this is so cool.
Do I have to poke myself with this thing? Is that like a thing that's going to make me bleed?
Yeah. That's what you're testing is your blood glucose. Yeah,
okay.
So there's a little pin. It's, you know, it's a really teeny tiny pin. A tiny drop of blood comes out. You put it on the first few times. You know, you feel it. You feel a little pinprick. And your fingertips
okay.
may feel a little bit sore.
I'll be fine.
But
I'm
you will. I do
it.
There's a video in there, too. And I explain all that in the video. And I actually show myself doing it, explaining the whole process. So,
excellent.
You know, watch the video and get really familiar with it. You'll get to the point where you can guide somebody off the phone. Let me see, Beverly, she's not on the call today, but she last week said she guided somebody over the phone to doing their blood glucose, and it went really well. She went, got her through the fear, and it's really good. And if you have them personally sitting there, you know, you can just look in their eyes, and you can hold their hand, you can help them. You can't do it for them unless you have a scope of practice that allows you to draw blood. Like if you're a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a doctor of some sort, a phlebotomist, you can do that. But you actually, from a legal standpoint, you have to have them do it. Okay?
Perfect.
Okay? And it's not that hard. We did it at our Spring Into Vitality event. We had 120 people in the room, and we had about 10 or 12 meters, and we passed them around. You have to have them change the lancet, the needle each time. And use the alcohol wipes and all. We had this room, 120 people all testing their blood sugar. Now, of course, a few of them opted out. It's going to happen. But it was really empowering for everybody to see it. And it got people really excited about purchasing their own and starting to test.
Fantastic.
Okay. Thank you for sharing. And Victoria. Hi. Victoria, are you there? Lee? No, it's not Victoria, maybe. There's a Victoria Lee. Georgia? Atlanta? If you have your hand up, speak, please.
Hi, it's Tracy Neely.
Tracy. Okay, it says Lee, L-E, and we have a Victoria Lee, L-E. And so I'm thinking it was Victoria, and then I thought, wait a minute, Georgia, she's in Dallas. So you were confused. Sorry about that.
Oh.
Hi. Tracy.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I tested mine. My fasting blood was 78.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I drank a green smoothie, I just wanted to check it again. I didn't probably wait long enough. I only waited maybe 15 minutes. It was 81.
Okay. Yeah, and so that's good. I mean, that's a really good fasting number. That's good. You're not getting it shot up. And when you look in the on the resource page, the glucose testing resource page, I've got a chart. It explains to you how often to test.
Yeah.
To just try to figure out a curve. And I'm going to share with you guys. You know, I teach you guys about the having that peak is usually around 45 minutes. Maybe it's 30 minutes. Maybe it's an hour. And I just had an experience on my own where my peak happened at almost 2 hours. It was about an hour and 45 minutes, and it shocked me because I thought, yay, I did a peach, and I decided to do a peach without any greens, without anything to slow it down. I was just going to eat this peach and enjoy it, and let me tell you, I enjoyed it. Big, huge peach. I probably ate it too fast. It took me about 5 minutes to eat this huge peach, and I tested my blood sugar before, and it was 85, and I tested it again at about 25 minutes later, and it was 97. And I was like, wow, I was excited, right, because it wasn't going up. And then I tested it again at close to an hour, or 45 minutes, I think it was, and it was 104. So I thought, okay, 45 minutes is right about my where the peak is going to be, and now it's going to start to go down. So I wanted to verify that. So I went and tested it again at an hour, and it was 137, and I was like, oh, that was a bummer. And then I tested it again, and it was an hour and a half, and it was 147. So I realized I can't eat peaches alone like that. But I'm just passing this on just because it really is a good idea to have your people test it, like I say, for the full duration to get the feel of what's happening. Because it may usually peak at 45. Mine almost always peaks at 45 minutes. And it
I'm sorry. I'm glad you brought that up. So later on during the Q&A, I did want to ask you regarding eating the protein just to slow down the absorption. But what if you try to just eat, like, low-sugar fruits on its own so it doesn't have to compete digestively? But
yeah.
I'll wait till that part of the call.
Okay. Yeah, make sure you bring that question up because we'll get to that. That's a good point. And we're going to go through some of the food stuff tonight and the supplements and also –
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And we'll take one more, and then we're going to go on. I have a few things I want to share. I want to give you a glimpse of part two. But I do want to make sure all your questions are answered, and we'll have plenty of time for Q&A later. So, Rainer in San Francisco.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. And your name is Rainer?
No, it's Christine. I'm on Renario's phone.
Okay. So, Christine. Hi, Christine.
Hi. So I haven't bought the thing yet. I've been really sick with a bad, bad chest cold.
Okay.
And it's just, I've just been lumping around.
Yeah.
And then I just tested my blood for the first time, but I didn't do, like, the fasting first. I had some, like, those imperial rolls from the Vietnamese store.
Okay.
And then they serve it with, like, a little bit of noodle, and I had the noodle. And then it was about 15 minutes after or so that I tested my blood sugar, and it was 158.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, man, yeah. So you're really sensitive to carbs.
Yeah.
You're really sensitive. Not good. So when you say an imperial roll, that's like a rice paper wrap with the veggies or meat or whatever inside of it?
Yeah, meat and veggies, carrots and meat.
Yeah. We'll go through the foods that are going to be good to keep things stable during tonight and then the ones that are to stay away from. And as we go through the program and we build on things, we're going to end with here's a 30-day program. Like, here's how to get things reset and what to do and what to guide people through. And I highly recommend you do it, which is why I have you in the Before Be Gone program, which will happen after this, starting in October. You'll be able to actually go through it yourself so you get to feel what it is and how to take people through it. So, yeah, it's very eye-opening. The first thing I ever tested was pineapple, and my sugar shot up to 167, and that's when I realized I had a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't all have problems. It's just if you find that out, then it's really critical that you take care of it yourself. And you're going to see a lot of shifts in your own body and how you feel and your energy and all. And that's going to help you to really see the importance of doing this with your clients.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Great. You're welcome. And I'm just going to take Patricia because her hand came up right as I was saying we're not going to take any more, and then that'll be it, and we'll take the rest of the questions after. So hi, Patricia.
Hi, Dr. Kamari. How are you?
Good. Yeah.
I have a technical question because I cannot access the website and I cannot access the dashboard.
When was the last time you tried?
Right now, and it says unresponsive.
It says unresponsive?
Yeah, the following pages have become unresponsive. So,
are you saying?
And if I go to the dashboard, I cannot enter my email and I cannot enter my, because the space is really narrow, and for some reason it doesn't go.
Is this something new or you had that problem before?
No, I never had that problem before.
So you've been in before?
Oh, I've been, yeah, for each call I've been there.
Oh,
yeah.
It might be, let me just check, it might be something going on. We've been working on this. I've got so many levels of tech support working on this, and we're actually, it's working right, try it again. It's working for me.
The dashboard or the web?
The website itself. You're saying the insulin resistance dashboard wasn't working, but you could get logged in?
I couldn't get logging, so.
Can get logged in. Okay, let me just click on that. Maybe Stacy was updating it for me.
No, I don't know. There is no space. It says email, and underneath there is a little line, but there is not like a box where I can enter my email and something for the password.
You've got to go. Okay, so go to vibrantlivingmembers.com.
Yeah, but this is where I am.
And does it say that? Does it say welcome, Patricia?
And it says member logging here.
Okay, so log. Put your name, your email address, and your password in.
But I can't. Let me see. Let me take this away and try this one. And
it's working. So, and other people, if you want to try it right now, see. And sometimes, you know.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
Got it. It may have been a temporary glitch, or maybe your internet temporarily went down, or our website temporarily went down, but good. I'm glad.
Well, I got into the dashboard. Now I'm going to see if I can go into the.
Okay. And for you, if you want to download the slides, like I said earlier, over on the left-hand side, and this will be every time we come in, we'll have, it'll say slides full page, slides four per
right,
page.
Yeah, and four page. Go to that. If I would understand, we are going for the food tonight because I heard you saying that you had some pineapple and you went to 157. But each food reacts differently, you know.
In different people.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I have somebody who made a smoothie with 8 bananas and some spinach, and her blood sugar went from 85 to 98. That's where it peaked. I have somebody else who had a grapefruit, or actually a half a grapefruit, and her sugar went from 85 to 185. So mm-hmm. It's real. That's why I'm teaching it this way. Most insulin resistance books and programs, including like Mark Hyman, great book, great stuff. He doesn't teach people how to test their glucose. He just says, follow these guidelines, and he'll say, okay, you know, rice is okay. Well, rice is okay for some people, but not others. So I want you to have that distinction of being able to work with people and customize their program so that they get the best results possible. And they think you're a hero because, you know, they read the book on insulin resistance and followed it. It didn't work because it wasn't customized to them. And that's especially what you want to listen for. If somebody says, well, I got this book and I've been eating a low glycemic diet and it's not working, that's where you say, look, a low glycemic diet for you might be very different than the low glycemic chart. Those low glycemic charts are created by taking thousands of people and feeding them a 50-gram serving of carbohydrate of a particular food. So like 3 pounds of watermelon, 2 slices of bread, et cetera, and then it's averaged over the group. Some people might have been way at the top of the curve and had their sugar go up to 185. Another group might be at the bottom of the curve and had, like, the person with the bananas only go up to 95. When you average it out, it may seem like a food is a low glycemic food. And you can certainly use the low glycemic charts as a guideline, and in part two we'll have all the resources you need to look these things up. However, I just have to reiterate, it's a guideline. And I will give you the program to have people follow if they're unwilling to test their blood sugar. We're going to put them on a really restrictive 30-day plan and test to see, and you'll be surprised at the results. I mean, pounds just melt away, inches melt away, brain fog melts away. I talked to somebody yesterday who was, oh, yeah, she was on Before Beyond the very first time I did it, and she... her Hashimoto's went away after 4 months. And then she told me yesterday she just went back to get her blood, not her blood, her bone density done, and her osteopenia went away. And she says, Dr. Rita Marie, I didn't do anything but do what you said to balance my blood sugar. I just followed the program. And my Hashimoto's went away. Her hypertension went away, too. She got taken off all her medication. And her blood sugar, of course, went from 120 fasting, 119 fasting, she was borderline, down to 85 fasting. She lost 75 pounds. And her osteopenia is now gone. So this is powerful stuff. It's super powerful stuff. You're going to learn how to really convert, turn people around. And it may be that missing link for some people that you're working with or potentially can be working with. Okay? You still there?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to everybody. Well, no, I got it.
Yeah. So that's why it's important to learn this, practice it, get good at the blood sugar, just really go through it. You might have to go through some of these pieces a few times,
yes.
Right? Because it's new stuff. And we learn about 10% of what we hear. You know, we add in the slides so you see it. So maybe you learn 20%. That still leaves another 5 times you're going to have to watch it before you get the whole thing, whatever's new. And so you'll get more and more. And when I'm learning new stuff, I listen, watch, read things over and over again until it becomes part of my physiology. And that's what you'll do with this. And then it'll be just nothing. Somebody will come in, they'll have these symptoms. You'll right away go, oh, I just look at them here, these symptoms. This person probably has insulin resistance. I'm going to get them to get a blood sugar meter. You know, I'm going to get them to do some of the things that I laid out in part one, right? Some basic food stuff. And then as you learn more about this, each of these sections, I'm going to help you to tailor it and customize it for the people that you're working with. Okay?
Yes, thank you.
Great, you're welcome. Okay, let me go on, and then if you have questions and they pop up as we're going along, you can either jot them down on a piece of paper and then type them in or ask them on the phone, or you can type them into the Q&A box as we're going along. All right, so let's go. We're going to be talking about, let me just get this out of the way for a second. I'm going to get the chat box up, so in case you do have any particular questions like, hey, I can't hear you anymore, I'll see it come across. Okay, so we're in rounds two. As usual, I like to remind you, and when you're working with people, have this disclaimer somewhere, you know, whether it's on the intake form that they do with you or something that they sign to let them tell you that they realize that you're not giving them medical advice, unless, of course, you are a medical practitioner, in which case it's fine. But if you're a nutrition coach, a health coach, an IIN certified coach, whatever you are, if you're not licensed to do diagnosis and treatment, just make sure that they realize that this is not intended to replace their one-on-one relationship with their doctor.
It's intended as education, and you're helping to educate them about their diet and how that affects, especially if they're on medication. So make sure that you have them, you know, that they're clear that they understand it. This is just a reminder of the schedule, where today is call 2, next week is call 3, Wednesday the 11th. Just a heads up. It's possible, I don't know yet, that our schedule may get interrupted and we may have to extend a week and give an extra week for a break, because I unfortunately broke my arm really badly and I have a displaced bone in my elbow, and I'm going to have surgery on Monday. Me, the person who is so haven't taken so much as an aspirin or even in 28 years and haven't even seen a medical doctor for anything, even a pap smear in 12 years, it's a little bit unnerving for me to be doing that, but I don't know what to expect, and I don't know what it's going to be like. That's happening on Monday. I fully expect to be fully functioning by Tuesday and be there, and then we'll work on getting stuff together. But I will be limited in my ability to type, so we may be a little bit delayed in getting new modules out to you. But believe me, you'll have enough going in module 1 and 2 that you'll be able to have plenty to keep you busy, it sounds like. So I just want to let you know that. And then part 1's open now. We're expecting to get it done. Part 2 to be open tomorrow. My assistant, Stacy, who does most of the web stuff, was away for a whole week. She was moving, plus I had the broken arm. So I'm a little bit behind on things that require typing. But the goal is to have it tomorrow, at least part of that, up. And I'll share with you some of the resources tonight that will be in there. If it's not done by tomorrow, it certainly will be by Monday, because that'll give me 2 days of no appointments where I can get it finished. And I have to take a lot of breaks when I'm typing right now. After Monday, I'm not going to be able to type much for 6 weeks. So with my left hand, I'll be good with one-handed typing. So I just want to give you the heads up, and hopefully you understand that, and it'll just give us extra time. You're not going to get shorted of any material or any calls. And if anything, we would be doing just an open Q&A next week. I just maybe not get the materials ready, and we may be just a week off, but you'll be good to go. If you haven't already joined the Facebook group, go out. And here's the link. It's drrenamarie.com/go-DRRLP. Facebook. I don't know who made that one up, but that's where it is. It's in the slides, and if you open up the slide, you can copy and paste it, or you can just click it usually, and that'll take you there if you haven't already joined. It'll be a little delay once you go to join and then you get in, because it is a closed group and we have to approve you, so we're only approving people who are in the program. So don't share the link with anybody. And that's actually not just the IRSPT people, but it's also people in my year-long practitioner certification program and also people who are in my client assessment tools. So any of my practitioner-level programs, and you all get to communicate out there, create, sharings and cases and all that sort of stuff. There hasn't been much activity, mainly because I haven't gotten in there very much, but go out there and just start conversations and share. And it's a great way to share resources, et cetera. And just a review, I'm just going to keep going over this. The normal blood sugar management. In order for you or your client to have good blood sugar management, it involves multiple organs. It's not just the pancreas. It's the pancreas, it's the liver, and it's the adrenals. And as we go through, we'll tie it all together, especially next, the Module 3 stuff. We're going to tie together the hormones and all the other organs and stuff that are involved. But right now, tonight, we're focusing on food. So liver, pancreas, and adrenals. When the blood sugar gets too high, your body secretes insulin, and that helps to, it's supposed to, actually, lower the blood sugar. And when the blood sugar gets too low, your body secretes glucagon, another hormone secreted by the pancreas, and that helps to increase the level of sugar in the blood. Insulin stimulates receptors on the cells so that the sugar can be carried across. We'll look a little bit further at the nutrients that are required for that and why it goes wrong. Glucagon basically goes out, and it first goes to the liver and stimulates the liver to secrete or release some of its stored sugar, and that's in the form of glycogen. It also can stimulate fat cells to release some of the sugars, and that's called lipolysis, or some people call it lipolysis. One or the other. It can also stimulate a process called gluconeogenesis, which mostly goes after protein stores and breaks down things like muscle, stored muscle. That's the one we don't want to happen. Glucagon, though, tends to favor glycogen and next fat. So first it'll look for the stored glucose in the liver and some of it in the muscles, break that down. When that goes away, if there's none of that available, like if somebody's on a fast, then it'll turn differently. So glucagon is your friend, and that balance of insulin glucagon is what allows you, or should allow you in the ideal situation, to go many hours between meals. If you don't make it to the next meal, if you're functioning properly, you get hungry, sure, you feel like eating, but your blood sugar doesn't crash because glucagon comes to the rescue and finds stored stuff. And even on a fast, a prolonged fast, I did a 28-day fast, it was fine. Your hunger just goes away because your body starts to basically eat itself and digest itself. This is what's happening in a well-balanced body, and this is what the goal is. Most of the people that you're going to be working with that have been identified as having blood sugar irregularities or insulin resistance or have that body type that you're going, you have insulin resistance and they don't even know, they're not functioning this way. The insulin's going too high. The insulin's not causing the sugar to go into the cells. The glucagon may not be secreted properly, or the glucagon may not be getting involved to help you, or the glucagon is causing the breakdown of the storage form of sugar into sugar, and then because you have insulin resistance, it's not really getting into the cells, and then you might be producing more and more insulin, and then finally there's a crash. There's a lot of different ways that this mechanism can go awry. And as we go through the program, I'll just keep reiterating and reviewing and adding layers to it so that by the time we're finished, you're going to really understand this process, and you're going to understand what's going on when somebody says, you know, I just can't make it more than 2 hours without eating, or 3 hours, I just feel like I'm going to crash and burn. That there's a problem there. That's not just, oh, it's just hypoglycemia. Eat every 2 hours. That's not solving the problem. It's suppressing the symptom. And in my book, that's similar to taking an aspirin for a headache. It's like, okay, it makes the headache go away, but it doesn't fix the underlying problem. You can eat to suppress the symptoms of hypoglycemia, to get rid of the irritability and the crankiness and the weakness, but you can't. You're not really fixing the problem, okay? And then all these different pieces that we'll be going through, each week we'll be adding on to it. Again, take it at your own pace. Wherever we're at with this, take it at your own pace. It's affected by stress, diet, and genetics, okay? So, again, I'm just going to review this in a different way, because when you see things in different ways, you are going to be feeling a little bit more confident about your ability to grasp it. You eat. Your blood sugar goes up. Your pancreas senses the blood sugar is above the healthy range, and it secretes insulin, which immediately gets put into the system. There's no delay. It's just like immediate. Insulin goes in and escorts the sugar into the cells. The blood sugar comes down. When I say immediately, like I said earlier, it usually gradual rise in the blood sugar. It peaks maybe at, you know, 45 minutes, a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour after you eat, and then it comes down. Because the insulin is supposed to be secreted right away by the pancreas and is supposed to have the ability to escort the glucose into the cells, the sugar should never rise above 110. And write that number down, because that's what you're going to be targeting for. Chances are that your client or you are eating foods, like Patricia said, went up to 147. Was it Patricia or, no, it was Tracy, said went up to 150-something, right? That's not right. So there's a dysregulation. So she's got something going on somewhere, and we're going to be going through and correcting it at different places. So the insulin gets escorted through the cells. The blood glucose decreases. A hormone called leptin, which we'll explore much more in part 3, gets secreted, and that gets secreted by fat cells to trigger fat burning to say we're full, we have plenty of fat, we don't need to store fat anymore, you don't need to eat anymore because we're full, and so let's just burn the fat. So the leptin is secreted by the fat to say, hey, I'm available, burn me, don't eat anymore, no need to release stored muscle, burn me. And then the pancreas stops secreting insulin because it gets that trigger not only from the blood sugar going down but from leptin being in the system. And leptin stimulates two places, the pancreas and the hypothalamus, but more on that next week. So then the pancreas stops secreting insulin. You get an increase in energy because all that glucose gets converted to ATP, which is the energy currency of your body. And then you just go along, and after a while, you know, once that's burned up, you get hungry again after several hours, and then you eat. So that's the normal cycle. And there's breakdown in a lot of different places here. And we've talked about that before. The pancreas can produce too much insulin, or the pancreas can be broken, as in the case of type 1 diabetes, where it's not producing enough insulin, or it's producing enough insulin, but your body's producing antibodies that kill off that insulin, that break it down, and you don't have enough, or you've got type 2 diabetes that's gone to the point where your pancreas gets burned out and you no longer make enough. So you can either not make enough insulin, you can make just the right amount, and that's when this perfect normal response happens, or the person can make too much. The triggers for what makes the pancreas produce too much insulin is what we're going to talk about tonight, and that's some of the foods, and that's what you're going to be right away getting in and helping people to turn around, okay? When you secrete too much insulin for too long, you become insulin resistant because the cells are like, they're hurting. They're like, this is too much sugar, too much insulin. They put their hands up and say enough, and then they become resistant. And that can develop into type 2 diabetes when the sugars rise too high as a result. And a lot of folks with type 2 diabetes that's not controlled properly with diet and exercise and stress management and all the things you're learning now, then they go on to wear out the pancreas because after a while it's been secreting too much insulin for so long, it gets worn out, then it doesn't secrete enough. And then those type 2 diabetics become dependent on insulin because their body's not turning it around. You will have the power to turn that around, to prevent those people from becoming type 2 diabetics, or if they've already been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you'll have the ability to help them to reverse it so they don't go into the depletion stage where now they have to do insulin. And I've seen it happen quickly in a matter of weeks. Depends on the person, how long they've had a problem, how well they're following your recommendations, and then there's some genetic factors that play in. And some people have to be more strict than others. But I've seen it reverse in as little as 3 weeks, where I had somebody go from having fasting blood sugars of 220 down to having a fasting blood sugar of 85 in a matter of a couple of weeks. So it really happens quickly. Just worked with somebody recently who'd been struggling with this for years, and her fasting blood sugar had never gone below 100. She just was always 104, 110, and not enough to say she's type 2 diabetic, but just higher than she wanted it to be, and we made one change in her diet. One, she'd been testing her fasting blood sugars all along because she'd been taught to. She'd never been taught to test her what we call postprandial blood sugar. What does the blood sugar do after you eat? And once I taught her how to do that, and I suspected something with her breakfast, I said, test your breakfast and tell me. And it went up, and I said, okay, I think it's the grapefruit, right? Low glycemic fruit, she thought was fine. She replaced the grapefruit in her breakfast with chia porridge. And voila, for the last month, her blood sugar is steady at 85 when she gets up in the morning. You can see these changes happen quickly. And then you're the hero. They're like, wow, why didn't my doctor tell me this sooner? So a lot of places where this can go wrong, and we're going to teach you how to intervene. It's not just about diet. You know, a lot of people think it's all about the food, everything's about the diet, and you just have to go on this diet. And no, it's more than the diet, it's more than the nutrition. Stress can raise the blood sugar dramatically. And we have a lot of people that I've taken through Before Be Gone that have said, oh my God, I realized my blood sugar was fine, and then I got this really stressful phone call and I was stewing, and I took my blood sugar and it shot up. And then the same thing with exercise. Exercise can bring it down. And I've had somebody, you know, getting into that situation where their blood sugar was high. She discovered that if she goes out and walks around the block a few times for about 10 minutes, brings her blood sugar into a manageable range. Sleep is huge. And we'll go into that next week on the studies. There's a lot of studies that show that even one night of bad sleep can cause insulin resistance. Temporary, of course, but, you know, see somebody who's on shift work or somebody who just is stressed and stays up late or has insomnia. That sleep is going to cause their blood sugar to be problematic. And finally, timing. We're going to start to talk about timing today, because you can be doing everything right but not timing it right, and that can be throwing off the blood sugar. And you need to be just really aware and cognizant of these different areas and start to talk to people about those and ask them questions so you can figure it out. So this is where we are. This is our overall schedule. This is slide 8. We had the kickoff call. We had the part 1. Those are posted to the membership site. Part 2, insulin resistance nutrition protocols, is where we are now. We're having this call. We're introducing it. Part 2 will be up on the website with lots of resources and charts and things like that to help you to start to put this into place. I recommend that you start working with it on your own. Even if your glucose levels are perfect, go ahead and just follow the strictest protocol yourself, just so you get the feeling for what it's like, because emotionally you're going to need to support people through this as well as giving them things to do. So take yourself through it. See what it feels like in your body. See what the adjustments are like. Going on a low glycemic diet for somebody who has blood sugar imbalances can be uncomfortable for the first couple weeks. Okay? Sometimes it takes up to, one of my mentors said 17 days, 14 to 17 days before your body kicks in to using fats more as fuel. And then you start to feel like really outstanding. So it could take a couple of weeks before the brain fog and some of those things go away. Next week we'll introduce the various emotion, stress, and sleep protocols, and that's where I talk about the hormones and all the hormone balances that happen, because sleep is when that hormone balance is really critical and why it's so important for maintaining sugar balance. Then we'll talk about the various protocols, the 30-day, and then I'll teach you how to put a program in place for yourself. So right now we're going to focus on the food. So last week, and in the kickoff call, we talked about that there's 5 steps. Last week I introduced the first part, which is insulin sensitivity, increasing the insulin sensitivity. And I said, you know, a lot of people jump right in and tell people what not to do. Stop eating this, stop eating that. And it's hard because there's cravings. So what I like to do is increase the insulin sensitivity, and we do that through some nutrients, and we'll review those nutrients tonight. That helps people to reduce their cravings. And if you immediately get them started on these nutrients, by the time you tell them what to avoid, they're not having the sugar cravings anymore. They're not having such severe swings, and they can follow through. I used to do it the other way around, and it works way better doing it this way. So this is the way I teach it now. And I find so many people, this is over and over again, it's almost across the board where I get them on the stuff, I don't start talking about the diet, and they're all of a sudden saying, wow, it's so nice not to have those sugar cravings anymore. And those sugar cravings, by the way, tend to be the strongest after eating. And if they're really off in their eating, it can happen worse after dinner. Like you eat a big dinner, they're full, but they have the sugar cravings. And you might experience that too, right? The nutrients that we'll talk about, I'll review them tonight, we talked about them last week, are really critical. Decrease the insulin need, that's going to be the focus of tonight, and also reducing inflammation. Some of the foods and things that we're going to talk about are going to help to decrease inflammation. When the cell receptors get inflamed, they are not going to be receptive to the insulin, and we need to reduce that inflammation. And we're going to be talking about fat burning and lean mass building more next week when we go into the sleep and the exercise and the stress, because it's getting the balance between a hormone called growth hormone and insulin. And it's overlooked a lot. And when you can optimize that, you're going to get dramatic results. And then finally, minimizing what I call the impact of candy bar eating effects of stress. And we talked about that last week, where when you get stressed, it's like you ate a candy bar, but you didn't get the fun, right? Your sugar goes up because it's released from storage, because glucose is released in order for you to run away from a tiger. So we'll go through that in detail. So tonight we're mostly going to be working on, I'll review the increase the insulin sensitivity. We're going to talk about in depth on decrease insulin need, and I'll share with you the resources I'll be putting up for you, and then reducing inflammation. So the symptoms of insulin resistance, again, in review, you're going to see this a lot. Belly fat, even on a thin person. Low energy, especially after meals, when you would expect somebody to have more energy. That low energy after meals says, boy, that sugar is not going where it's supposed to. hungry even after a full meal. Again, the food didn't go where it's supposed to. That mid-afternoon energy slump because it's crashing, the blood sugars are crashing, difficulty focusing, and then cranky and irritable if they skip a meal. Those are the main symptoms. There's a whole lot more, and in part one, I gave you an access to an insulin resistance questionnaire that you are welcome to use. Mine is an online, and you can get your own back, but you can use that, copy and paste it into a Word doc, and create your own, add your own other questions, reword the questions, you know, if you don't like the way I worded them, but you want to word them differently, ask questions, or just take it and incorporate it into your own questionnaire. If you have somebody fill out an intake and a diet intake and their basic stats, you can just add these questions to it. So however you want to use it, that works best in your own practice. So let's review and introduce some new nutritional causes of insulin resistance. Right? We already talked about the obvious, which is eating too much sugar and the receptors get burned out. But there's more to it than just that. An omega-3 fat called DHA is super important. And when it gets deficient in the cell membranes can't accept the signal of insulin. And that creates insulin resistance. When you are working with somebody and their omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratio is off, if it's too high, the omega-6 to omega-3 fats are too high, then they're going to have damage to the membranes, and those membranes aren't going to be as receptive. You know who has omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratios too high? Almost everybody in this U.S. Western world, and some people in other countries as well. It's very common because of the foods that people eat. They're eating too many polyunsaturated fats. They're eating too many processed fats, too much omega-6, not enough omega-3. Omega-3 comes from, you know, chia, hemp, flaxseed, walnuts, and fish, and algae, and purslane. Okay, those are the main sources. There's not a whole lot. A lot of people go on a healthier diet and throw off their omega-3 and 6 ratios and are wondering why they're having issues, because they're suddenly drinking almond milk by the quart instead of dairy milk. Well, yeah, that could be great if they're allergic to dairy and dairy causes sensitivities. Dairy has its whole host of problems. However, just switching to almond milk creates a plethora of omega-6 fatty acids. Not a great idea. So what I will have on your chart is a spreadsheet that you can use, and you can plug in numbers and you'll see the ratios for various fatty foods, both vegan foods and fish and meat, how much omega-3 they have, how much omega-6 they have, and what's the ratio. And then I give you the recommendation for a 3-to-1 ratio between omega-6 and 3. It could be more omega-3, so you can have a 2-to-1 ratio or a 1-to-1 ratio. You don't want to get more. You don't want to get lower than a 1-to-1 ratio, because too much omega-3 can cause your blood to get too thin. But that sheet is a phenomenal tool that you can use with people. And again, you can take it and you can modify it, and you can add your own, you know, tweaks to it. And that's something that you'll be able to use with your clients. And it's an awesome spreadsheet. And I also have recipes in the one that I'm going to give you. Those are my recipes. You can plug your own recipes in and figure it out. The way I like to use that spreadsheet is when I create a new recipe is just plug in the fatty pieces in there, and I'll go, oh, my God, the omega-6 to 3 ratio is 17. That's not good. How do I shift it? I'll go, well, if I take out some of the almonds and I put in a few cashews or some coconut instead, or I put some walnuts or hemp seeds or one of the omega-3s, and I play with it until I get a really nice ratio. You play around with it. You test the recipe, and it really helps you to create guidelines for your people to be on good. And there's 5 recipes in that spreadsheet that you'll have. Trans fats in the cell membrane. So many people are eating trans fats, and some of them don't even know it. Like margarine, mayonnaise, Crisco, those all, and the things that say partially hydrogenated soybean oil, those are things that are obvious. Chips and crackers and all that kind of stuff has that. But what people don't realize is there's also trans fats that get created in the food when you heat them. So if you were to take, say, safflower oil or sunflower oil or corn oil and you were to saute it, that is going to create trans fats because of the oxidation of those fats and can shift those around. Okay. Oxidized fats are as bad as trans fats. People don't realize that. So we'll have it in the guidelines, like what you're going to be sharing with people to avoid. And of course, as you incorporate changes to their diet, you want to go slow. You don't want to just shove it down their throats unless they come in and they go, look, my doctor's going to put me on insulin next week. If I don't, what do I do? You know, you tell them, like, okay, this is serious. I'm going to give you this list, and I want you to just do everything on this list. And then they're really motivated at that point. But most people are like, okay, give me one thing at a time, two things at a time. So you'll be feeling out each person you're working with to see what they can handle. Of course, deficiencies of chromium, magnesium, zinc, B vitamins, boron, lithium, basic deficiencies create insulin resistance. And we're going to look at specifically how the chromium and magnesium look. And we're also going to show you tonight some specific foods that help you, that help the resistance to get better. Eating high glycemic snacks and meals and sweet drinks, of course, that shoots up the sugar and creates a resistance. And also insufficient protein. And I want to address this one because it's not just insufficient protein in the diet. You may have somebody who's eating plenty of protein, but they're not getting it into their cells. And there's a few markers you can look at on a blood panel. We go through that in a lot of detail in the Client Assessment Tools for Holistic Practitioners, CAT. We call it CAT for short, the CAT program. But in general, BUN, B-U-N, or protein, globulin, albumin, those numbers on your blood test will say, well, this person might have a low protein. And when you ask them and you find out, well, yeah, you know, I eat bacon and eggs for breakfast and they're eating plenty of protein, then you're going to suspect malabsorption. And that can be related to stomach acid. We go through that in depth in how to correct that and all in our year-long coaching program. So it's insufficient protein. It doesn't matter how much is in the diet, it matters how much is getting in. And that protein will throw off the resistance and it will cause them to become more insulin resistant. So an overview of what your goal is in helping them put a plan in place to reverse this. And number one is get the nutrients in place like we talked about in part one, and we're going to review those tonight. That's the nutrients that help to restore insulin sensitivity. I'm going to give you guidelines, but I'm going to give you also a whole list of various ones. You may get fortunate with most people and just do the top three and they get results, but there's also times when you need to be adding more of the herbs, more of the nutrients that we're going to talk about and will be shared in depth on the site. I'm giving you an overview tonight, but there's a lot more information. I want to give it to you in a lot of different ways, so repetition causes it to sink. Carbohydrate avoidance, we want to keep the sugars below 110. I always have to share with people, I'm not a low-carb advocate. I'm a perfect amount of carb advocate. What's the right amount of carb for that person? Like I said, some people can eat 8 bananas and only have their sugars go up to 98. That person doesn't need to start avoiding all their carbs, whereas someone else eats a half a grapefruit and it goes to 185. They have to be more careful. A lot of things play into it. Their early diet, their genetics, their weight, other health conditions. So we're going to focus on doing a plan with people and putting together a 30-day plan for your person where they're going to keep their sugars below 110. And I'll share with you how we do that. Avoiding allergens. I have a list of the top 6 allergens, and that will be incorporated on the site. I usually look at gluten, dairy, corn. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Say that 5 times fast. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. So it took me a while to get that memorized and be able to say it that way. So those are the 6 top allergens. Does it mean that every client you work with is allergic to one or more of those? No. But I like to put people on a program for about 30 days where they avoid those and help to, and see if they can decrease inflammation in the process, because that's going to help their insulin resistance. And then we talk about, I'll share with you a way that you help them to reintroduce things. And we go through that, all of those stages, in the Before Be Gone program, which you'll be going through in October after we get through all of this. Then there's foods that aid in insulin sensitivity. I have charts. I'm going to share some of them tonight, but I have charts that you'll have on the website that you can print out, that you can create your own version of. You can add to it if you want, however you want to do it. There's herbs that assist in blood sugar management, and I'm going to go through a little bit of the mechanisms of some of those so that you can kind of
get an idea if there's certain ones that may or may not be best for your client. The nutrients that helps keep the blood sugars balanced. There's the basic ones, and then there's others as well. And then finally, the timing of meals for optimum insulin growth and hormone balance. This is the basis of the nutritional pieces that you're going to need. We'll be going over these and over these and over these. I will be providing you with videos and audios and charts and whatever is appropriate to help you to provide the information you need to share this with your clients. So last time in part one, we talked about some introductory food guidelines, and I gave you some PDFs that had this stuff in it to just get their feet wet, right? I remember I said last week, start with takeaways, start with ads. Teach them about making green smoothies if they don't already know that. Teach them about juicing greens if they don't already know that. Teach them about omega-3 fats if they don't already know that, right? You sense where they're at. There's a package of little beverages that you can get them started on that are fun and delicious. So you just get them started on some things. So the documents that you have in part one, shopping guidelines, which you know, people aren't used to shopping this way. They're not used to maybe eating a lot of produce. They're used to going to the fast food and the frozen food aisle. So it's like how to stock a healthy pantry and where can you order things online. So that's a guideline that you have in part one. Hydration, there's a whole thing on how do you get them to drink right, right? Somebody can be dehydrated. This whole process is going to be thrown off. I give you a digestion strategies PDF. Greens, like an introduction to greens, what they are, how they work, charts, and some recipes, a beverages document, and then we talk about omega-3 rich foods, chia, hemp, etc. These are things that you have and you're going to use as you put together your handouts to hand people during a program that they're doing with you, whether it's a one-on-one program or you're doing it as a group. I highly recommend that you take some people through this one-on-one before you tackle a group because the dynamics, you'll learn more the dynamics and what problems people come into. And if you're suddenly never done this before and you've got six or eight people you're guiding through it, it's a challenge. I did this for many years with people one-on-one, many, many years. And then I decided to offer it as a group. And my first group program, I shockingly got about 110 people in. And I was very happy that I had 20 years of experience with this going through that because a lot of stuff can come up. And we're going to be looking for people who get certified as insulin resistance practitioners and are really good at this. We're going to be I'm going to have people help me in doing group programs to provide more one-on-one and support for people. So I'm going to be looking for people who really master this and want to do that and are, you know, good practitioners that way. Nutrients. So these are the basic ones, chromium, magnesium, and DHA, and there's a comprehensive PDF that has all the supplements and chromium, magnesium, DHA, explains them, explains sources, places you can get them, dosages. So I highly recommend you look at that, and that's in part one. And let me just talk a little bit about the mechanisms because I know, you know, you guys are practitioners and people are going to ask you, well, why does that work and how? And if you understand it a little bit more, then you're going to be able to explain it to them. So why is chromium important in blood sugar metabolism, right? Why? Because it is important to escort that insulin molecule across with attached to the sugar across the cell membrane. It helps the insulin receptors to move it across, right? And this is a picture of the, you know, it's a protons and neutrons, and it's just a scientific picture. It's more for making the thing, you know, pretty than anything else. But that's basically, this is a molecule. I mean, it's a chromium. 800 micrograms a day is the recommended dose. I like you to go through, I like to get people, if they are willing to do it in divided doses, 200 micrograms per meal and then one at bedtime. The one at bedtime helps to maintain the blood sugar levels in the overnight. That's especially important if somebody is waking up with really high blood sugar. If somebody's waking up in the middle of the night hungry, you probably don't want to give them that chromium at bedtime, okay? But they usually come in 200 microgram capsules, and so you can do them two per meal. Some of them come in formulas where there's 300 per. So you'll get 900, no big deal. So it's, you know, it's all guidelines approximate. Some people need less, And when we get to talking about what do you do after you've had them go through a 30-day program to determine what they can add back in, we'll talk about how to work with the supplements then. Chromium promotes the binding of insulin to the cells, so it's really important. It's stored in the liver in between meals, and it's released whenever the insulin gets secreted. If you take it with the meal, then it just saves your body a little extra work, right? So the liver doesn't have to secrete it. You've actually got it there. Elevated and prolonged insulin curves, okay? That's like I had the other day, right, where my sugar was up at 147 at an hour and a half or whatever. That's a long insulin curve. I was really using up a lot of chromium. And the one thing that I did think about afterwards, I should have thought about during, was to put some chromium in a glass of water. And actually, I did at the end of that hour and a half. I actually took some chromium in water to help bring it down. So, and it basically strips mine all the chromium. And I hadn't taken it because I'm not good at taking supplements throughout the day. I had taken my chromium in the morning. And I'm trying to think if I even took my chromium because I'm not very regular in taking it all the time. It's important to get people to be regular with it, especially when they're having these issues. So that's it. So it's kind of a vicious cycle that you have to stop. Excess insulin promotes the excretion of chromium. Deficiency of chromium then promotes you to produce more insulin. So it's this vicious cycle. So we stop it by giving them the extra chromium. Do they have to stay on 800 micrograms of chromium for the rest of their life? It depends. I mean, if somebody is a type 2 diabetic and you're using this protocol to reverse that and they're getting good, you've got to test. You don't want to just take them off. Okay, you've done it. Stop the chromium. There's a whole process that we'll talk about towards the end of this, is how do you put people back and see what they have to do long-term for maintenance. Magnesium, what's its mechanism? Well, again, different amounts. It's 400 to 800 milligrams per day, so it's milligram dose. You need a lot more magnesium than you need chromium, 1,000 times more, right? 400 to 800 milligrams versus micrograms. This is the magnesium molecule. Insulin produces loss of magnesium. It kind of acts like a diuretic, if you know what that is. It makes you pee away the excess magnesium. So when you have too much insulin, as in hyperinsulinemia, you get a lot of magnesium being lost. And then magnesium is essential for the cellular response. So for the cells to pick up the insulin, you have to have enough magnesium. So you've got, again, this situation where when you have too much insulin, which is produced as a result of insulin resistance because the insulin's not getting into the cells, then you pee away the magnesium, and then that low magnesium that results makes you even more insulin resistant, so breaking the cycle by adding the 400 to 800 milligrams per day. However, they may need more than that, and that's just a guideline. And in the part two documentation, I've got a chart that's the magnesium loading document, and it teaches you how to teach your clients how to know how much magnesium they really need, how to really tailor that to them. And I'll let you read that, but it has to do with bowel tolerance, similar to when you do that with vitamin C. So it's important for them to be replenishing their nutrients. We talked already about the chromium and magnesium. DHA, which I said was important for the cellular membrane, a deficiency in the cell membrane will decrease insulin sensitivity, 300 to 500 milligrams per day. That's an omega-3 fat. And some people need more. The people that need more tend to be the people that have more brain fog, who tend to have problems with ADD, with memory, with mental function, because DHA is important for the neurologic function. So they may need 500. They may need a little bit higher than that. You'll just kind of use that as a starting point. When you get them to eat lots of green leafy vegetables and sea vegetables, you're loading them up on minerals, B vitamins, antioxidants. And in sea vegetables, there is also a little bit of omega-3 fats, especially in the algae. So how else are they going to replenish through food? Chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds for omega-3s. And a little hint here, I always have people do coconut with their omega-3 fats because there were a few studies that said that coconut will actually increase the conversion of the short-chain omega-3 fats into DHA and EPA by tenfold. The first research I saw on that was by Gabriel Cousins, and he quoted some studies on it, so if you want to look that up. But there's a mysteric acid, which seems to be one of the fatty acids in the coconut that tends to have the most effect on that conversion, but also lauric acid as well, to an extent. Pumpkin seeds are a good source of zinc, important for this. Brazil nuts, a good source of selenium. Protein powder is important for those folks who are showing protein deficiency, and a lot of folks with the insulin resistance are starting the day with a high-carb breakfast. They're not getting enough protein. They're eating a standard American diet. They're eating under stress, and they don't get enough zinc, and that's affecting their stomach acid. The stomach acid affects their absorption of both minerals and protein. So that protein deficiency can be caused by a dietary inadequacy. You know, some people are just kind of trying to make it through the day drinking green juice and nothing else. Or they're just eating donuts and coffee all day long and they have a protein deficiency. Because a lot of people are so carbohydrate addicted that that's what they eat all day. Or they have the impaired digestion. So it's up to you to learn that. Small quantities of lean, organic, free-range animal protein or fish for people that may want to get that instead of the extra protein powder or in addition to it. And so some people, when they're in the state of really severe insulin resistance, don't do well unless they continue to include, or they do include, a little bit of lean, organic, free-range animal protein. And I've worked with a few people like that who wanted to go raw, they wanted to do vegan, and they couldn't do it. They needed to have it. But they're doing all the same things as somebody who is raw or vegan, but they're including a little bit of fish or free-range meat or buffalo or something with their meals. So this doesn't have to be a vegan or raw foods program, and it doesn't have to include animal protein. And that's where this differs, what I'm teaching you differs from what you're going to read mostly. If you see a lot of the insulin resistance books or even Mark Hyman's book, there's a lot of animal protein in there. And people who are choosing to be vegetarian and who prefer not to eat quite that much animal protein are having to really massage the recipes, where it's much easier to start with really balanced whole foods, high vegetable recipes, and then say, well, you can add 3 ounces of fish to this, or you can stir fry in 3 ounces of meat with this stir fry. So that's how I prefer to give it. Personally, I'm vegan. I've been vegan for 28 years, and I do really well that way. Some people I work with don't, and some of it may be the genetics, some of it may be cultural, some of it may just be psychological. So, you know, really, if you are vegan or raw and you're tending towards wanting your people to go that way, really understand that they can do really well if they can do most of that stuff and include a little bit of protein. So optimizing the level of nutrients, here's some amounts. There's a whole document, a supplement checklist for improving insulin sensitivity. It's a PDF document that you have. I believe it's already on the part one page. If not, it'll be on the part two page. The vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams 3 times a day, is a good starting point, but it's really good to get people on as much as they need. And I've given you a document called Vitamin C Calibration to give you instructions on how to go there. D3 is critical, and I think that they should get their vitamin Ds tested and get them in the range of 75 to 100. Now, if they live in Canada, in Montreal, or someplace up there, Winnipeg, they could lay naked on their roof all winter long, and they're not going to get any vitamin D because the sun it's not direct enough. And what happens, actually, it's considered that anything north of Atlanta, Georgia, you don't get enough direct sun in the winter to have reasonable exposure to sunshine, keep it steady. So you either have to have somebody who just loads up on sunshine throughout the summer, maintains a high level, and then they check throughout the winter to make sure. Really recommend that for a year, people get their vitamin D levels tested every 3 months to see how the outdoor exposure, how the sun exposure affects it, and what kind of supplementation they need to do to maintain it. I supplement people from anywhere from 1,000 IUs to 20,000. Depends on where they're at, okay? We go through that in more detail in other programs like the thyroid program. So vitamin B complex, overall energy and hormone support. So it's really critical for maintaining looking at their levels, and if they're eating a lot of processed foods, they're going to need a lot more B-complex. If they've been eating a whole foods diet for a long time and they get lots of sea vegetables and greens, they may not need as much. They may be just fine with getting it through food. And then the magnesium loading document I gave you to ensure the adequate magnesium intake is critical. Magnesium is important for over 325 different enzyme systems in the body. You want to get them to trash some foods, okay? Strictly for at least the first 2 weeks and ideally for 30 days. The only way that, you let them get away with testing some of the more innocuous of these foods after 2 weeks is if they're really improving and they're really begging you and they're willing to test their glucose very rigorously to see. So the things that need to go, high glycemic carbohydrates. That includes a lot of different things. We have a whole separate page on that. Processed fats, trans fats, oxidized fats, heated fats. All the fats need to be unprocessed whole food fats, with the exception if they want to have a little bit of olive oil in a stir fry or coconut oil in a stir fry, that's okay. But any other fats heated and large amounts of those, just using the oils freely. Oils, when they're processed, are going to have some degradation no matter how careful the processing is. So I prefer the whole food fats, avocado, coconut, nuts and seeds, those sorts of things. Top allergens and all known allergens. So not only the six top allergens, but if they know that they're allergic. You'd be surprised how many people will say, wow, I'm allergic to, every time I eat eggplant, I get hives and whatever, you know, and I have to, you know, lay low or take vitamin C afterwards. And you say, how often do you eat eggplant? Oh, you know, just not often, once a week or so. You're like, why do you eat something you know that you're causing an adverse effect in your body for? During this process of resetting their insulin receptivity, it's really important to keep the inflammation down. So get them to look at what foods they know they've been allergic to in the past or have been had a test that said they are or that they've just reacted to. Plus, get them to avoid those top six allergens. Say, look, we're just going to do this for a month, and then we're going to let you test. Gluten is critically important to avoid for longer than that because the effects of gluten can cause inflammation for way longer. Gluten affects the brain. It affects the bones. It affects the gut. And if you're not off of gluten, and you're even the slightest bit sensitive, their gut's going to be leaky, it's going to be irritated, and they're not going to be getting all this great nutrition you're teaching them about. So you want to look at foods and combinations that raise insulin but not glucose. We talked about those last week. You can review that. There was a couple of fishes. There's a chart that I'll have in this module that will show you the insulin index and the glycemic index. And then commercially grown food as much as possible. That's one that it's really hard to be 100% on that, but the commercially grown food, the pesticides have been shown to affect insulin receptors. Gabriel Cousins in his book, Reversing Diabetes, talks about that. You want to break the vicious cycle of high glycemic carbohydrate addiction. People don't realize that the addiction is not just them being weak. It has to do with physiology. High glycemic carbs promote excess insulin, and then the normal cells adapt to the high levels by turning off and thus require a very large amount of insulin to open up. Say, nope, I'm not going to do this. And then when you get the levels up high enough, they have issues going on. So hypoglycemia leads to cortisol. Oh, high insulin leads to hypoglycemia. Why? Because now they've had to produce a lot of insulin to get anything to open up. Mostly it's the fat cells that open up, so it's stored as belly fat. But then that leads to the sugar going down rapidly, and then they have hypoglycemia, which leads to cortisol secretion because it's an emergency, or adrenaline spikes, and that starts to reduce their muscle stores and break that down into sugar. And that creates a craving for the high glycemic carbs. So it's a vicious cycle that needs to be broken. And how are you going to do it? You're going to eliminate the high glycemic carbs and processed fats. Some of these are no's. Regardless of whether they want to test their blood sugars or not, I just recommend they stop it. No sugar or any relatives. No coconut nectar, agave, anything that has any glycemic at all. because some people, coconut nectar, yes, low glycemic sugar raises your sugar up to 160. No, thank you. So I recommend they get off of all of that. Stevia, xylitol, erythritol, Lohan, Lakanta, those are sugars that are okay. They're low they're no glycemic. And small amounts, because some people have irritation if they have too much of those. I get them off of all flour, crackers, breads, pasta, even no gluten stuff, right? Gluten-free crackers, gluten-free pasta, gluten-free bread, they're usually made with refined flours. Flour raises the insulin levels, the sugar levels, and then the insulin levels way more quickly than a whole grain carbohydrate. But during this reset period, which I like it to be at least 3 weeks, but I normally do a 30-day period, I don't have them do any grains, possibly quinoa, if they really need to do it or they're very active athletically, or if they are very thin and they need the calories. And if they test the glucose and it's normal, and we'll share with you, I'll review with you what normal means on the next slide. No legumes unless the glucose is tested normal, okay? And it has the normal curve. And legumes may peak a little bit later because they're a little bit slower to be absorbed, but if they shoot the sugar up to 140, it's no good. Remember last week, if you don't remember, recheck the presentation from last week. I talked about how whenever the sugar goes above 120, 140, you get various changes to the retina and the peripheral nerves. So real important stuff. No potatoes because they tend to shoot people's sugars up, although this isn't across the board. Some people eat potatoes with no problem. But sweet potatoes, yam, and squash tend to not raise the sugar as much. So if they really need that extra carb and they need that fillingness, you can have them test those. And if the glucose testing says it's okay, meaning they follow their curve out from before they eat up to about 3 hours, 4 hours after they eat, and their sugars never go above 110 and never go below where they started, then they can include it. It's not going to be a problem. I keep them off of all the bananas, mangoes, papaya, and other high sugar fruits because they do cause those swings. No dried fruit, no fruit juice. Avoid the heated oils and trans fats, like I said before. And low glycemic only fruits in small quantities, like blueberries. For some people work, for others they don't. For some people the blueberries will work if they eat it on a salad or with some lettuce, but not blended. That's me. I can't eat it blended because it goes in too quickly. Probably because I drink the smoothie too quickly, but either way, I don't do it that way anymore. But you work with the people, and you help them. You look at their charts, and you help them through. And we'll talk about charting and tracking in a bit. You want to balance their omega-3s and 6s, avoiding the oxidized fats, ideally no oils at all. We've talked about all this before, no margarine, mayonnaise, corn oil, soybean oil, vegetable oils. The only oils in very moderate amounts would be olive or coconut, lightly heated, although not ideal, or a little bit of cold flax oil. Especially if they tend to need the extra calories. Most of the people you're going to be working with this problem are not going to be concerned about losing too much weight. They're going to be concerned that they have too much weight. But quite frankly, the ones that are thin and insulin resistant are a little bit harder to deal with because they tend to lose a lot of weight. When I first did the low glycemic thing because of my issue, I had to be really careful to make sure that I didn't lose too much weight. And in fact, I did. I dropped down to about 106 pounds when I first started doing it. And then I figured out my way of what I needed to be eating to keep it up without the carbs. So I've been doing this low carbohydrate thing for about 2 years. I keep testing my sugars. Because I'm so busy and I don't often do the sleep part that I know I should, I haven't responded as quickly as other people have. If you get them to do all the pieces, they generally respond at least majorly changed within 30 days. Will they then be able to go back and eat, you know, ice cream again without having a sugar problem? No, right? You want them to stay away from that stuff. But you give them the tool, the glucose meter is their tool to be able to see how they can not restrict their diet versus restrict it. Somebody wanted to not do it, and I knew she was having some issues, and I said, look, you can either do the 30 days on the strictest protocol of all and see how it goes, or you can get the glucose meter and test some things and see if blueberries are okay, see if lentils are okay for you. And she finally agreed to get the glucose meter after not wanting to do it for a while. So it's cool when you can get people to do that. But if they're so resistant and so needle phobic, then you just put them on the strictest program, and then they learn to see how they feel then, and you have to work with them a little bit more closely when they start to introduce foods, because it's not this objective thing, like the sugar goes up. It's more like they subtly don't feel as good, or they have a crash, or so you're watching them more carefully. The more you do this, the easier it becomes, and the more natural it becomes. I have a whole book of glucose balancing beverages, something I call the AM Gut Rejuvenator, which I took from a digestive balancing course I did a couple of years ago. It helps people get steady in the morning. People always say it feels so good, so I incorporate that. Blended green drinks, also called green smoothies or green soups, green drinks, energy drinks, flavored water, where it's just essential oils in the water. And there are certain essential oils like cinnamon and orange and lemon and grapefruit and caraway and dill that actually help with the blood sugar balance. Caraway and dill are not so great on their own, but they're good in foods. And then protein shakes. So all of these things are explained in the beverages document. And also the other document that you guys have is my blood glucose 30-day program. It's From Before Be Gone. It's a 30-day menu plan, and you can adapt that to the people you're working with. You can create your own from it. There's recipes in there. They can follow. You can follow. It's just an awesome guide. And you can create recipes based on those, too. You can create your own recipes. That's what most people end up doing. These are some resources that are on the part two page. I already talked about the omega 3 and 6 content of common foods. There's a PDF version of it, which is just printed out. You have to do the calculations yourself. But there's an Excel version for those of you who are spreadsheet savvy that you can put the numbers in and it calculates for you. There's a chia seed nutrition chart. There's a foods that improves insulin sensitivity chart, foods affect on glucose and insulin chart, how the glycemic index of foods are measured resource. There's herb list. There's a supplement list, the magnesium loading, vitamin C calibration, food sources of potassium page. And the reason we put that in is because people started to develop slight potassium deficiencies when they first started doing this and getting leg cramps. So that's something to watch for. If they start to get leg cramps when you put them on the magnesium and take them off the high glycemic foods, because a lot of the high glycemic foods are good sources of potassium. So we have a food sources there like broccoli and avocado and other things. And then finally, I've given you the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 list so that you can help them to reduce their pesticide consumption. And this is a copy of it. And this is just downloaded from the FDA site. Gabriel Cousin says, "In There Is a Cure for Diabetes, Pesticides May Damage Insulin Receptors." It's an awesome book. It's big and thick, and I'm giving you, all the general stuff. He gives you a lot of the background stuff. So if you want to learn more, he doesn't go quite into some of the pathways and the metabolic pathways as much as I do because it's written for lay people, but it's a good book, and they've got some good recipes in there as well. There's a new version of it, too. So here's some of the foods that improve insulin resistance on the site. There'll be a list with the description of these and some of the mechanisms behind it. Broccoli, avocado, alfalfa, blueberries for some people. See, blueberries have a chemical that improve insulin resistance, but the sugar in it may increase the sugar and people in early stages can't go with it. So you have to see. Greens, Brussels sprouts, citrus peel extracts. So even if you just like to use the little kind of like a microplaner to take the skin off, you can blend the citrus peel or get extracts like the lemon oil or whatever. Turmeric, stevia actually can help improve insulin resistance. Bitter melon, prickly pear, nopal cactus is awesome at it. There's actually a supplement that Health Force Nutritionals makes. They used to just call it nopal cactus, and now they call it blood sugar balancer. And it's got the nopal cactus in it. So those are good things, and these are the things that you can encourage people to start to use and use more freely. And cinnamon, for people who have resistance, it's just slow to go down. You can get them to do a tablespoon a day of cinnamon as a tea mixed in with a pudding, put on top of their chia porridge, really helpful. Cardamom, ginger, algae, and seaweed. In addition, I didn't put on here, where's my carob? I didn't put carob and cacao. I didn't put cacao because there's some mixed feelings about it, But carob for sure. Oh, I think it's on the next chart where I go into more details. Yes. So here's some others. Jerusalem artichoke, it has inulin, and that helps to maintain the blood glucose levels. Cabbage has a chemical called beta-oleracea, and that's an antioxidant that helps to increase insulin sensitivity. Cucumber has a substance that's needed by the beta cells to produce insulin, and Gabriel Cousins writes a lot about that in his book. Garlic and onion contain sulfur, which helps, and then carob contains a substance called pinetol, which helps. Cacao is mixed. Some people say it's not worth it because it's too stimulating. Some people do really well with it, and it can help bring it down. Some of these foods are more effective than others. I know people who will eat something, their blood sugar goes up too high, they'll eat a half an avocado, and it drops it back down. Same with chia. So just help your people with this and working with these foods and really teach them how to do the glucose monitoring, because that's going to really help them through it. Herbs are your friends in this regard. People can incorporate these freely. They can take them as supplements or they can take them as food. Fenugreek lowers insulin and triglycerides and increases HDL. So it's good for insulin resistance, and it's also good, it's especially good for people who've gone beyond the just plain insulin resistance into metabolic syndrome. Cinnamon enhances insulin receptor sensitivity. Maitake improves sensitivity and lowers sugar, insulin, and triglycerides. So again, it's good for the people who've gone beyond because it's affecting the triglycerides. So maitake is it's an awesome mushroom. You can get it as a powdered extract or as a powder. You can make mushroom broths and things with it. You can also sometimes get it fresh. We have a store here locally that sometimes has fresh maitake, and you can also get the whole ones dried, and then you can soak them and make them into soups and put them into stir fries and things like that. Bitter melon lowers both your insulin and triglycerides, so that's cool. Basil improves insulin sensitivity. Nopal, they don't really understand the mechanism other than it does slow the absorption of sugar through the intestinal wall. And ginger decreases inflammation, which is really cool, and it increases sensitivity. A few more, and these are controversial, so I pulled these out and put them on separate slides, gymnema and ginseng. So gymnema sylvestre, is touted as an excellent herb for lowering blood sugar, and indeed it does lower blood sugar. It slows the absorption of glucose. The problem is it may increase insulin production. However, it's possible that insulin resistance improving capabilities override that, but you just have to be careful with people who have insulin resistance. Good for people with type 1 diabetes because it'll help lower the glucose and increase the insulin, which is what you want. Or in those folks who've progressed to type 2 diabetes at later stage, where they tend to be not producing at all and the docs want to put them on insulin. So keep this in mind. Just be careful using it with people with the earlier insulin resistance and the hyperinsulinemia stages. Ginseng, again, decreases the blood sugar and doesn't have effect on serum lipids, so it's not as good as some of the others in that regard. But it's theorized that it reduces the glucose by slowing the intestinal absorption of the glucose. Not really sure. Again, it might raise insulin. It's unclear if it does as much as the gymnema or if it does at all, but there's some studies that indicate that it might. So again, be careful of people who have advanced insulin resistance and are hyperinsulinemic. But it's also so good for the adrenals, and it's an adaptogen, so it can indirectly improve insulin resistance by overall decreasing cortisol levels and keeping everything steady. So these are the ones that just use cautiously, learn about them, study them, and just, you know, watch out who you use them for. So as you're putting somebody on a program, you want to give them foods that they can eat in unlimited quantities. Like, hey, eat as much as you want of these foods. Vegetables, raw or cooked, unlimited, except the high-carbohydrate vegetables. Be careful with things like carrots and beets and squash and sweet potatoes. I find that personally, if I grate raw carrots, I'm fine, but if I cook the carrots, at least the last time I tried, I haven't tried it in probably a year, but when I was first testing, I found that cooked carrots would raise my blood sugar. So just have people watch that. But unlimited quantities of their greens and broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage and all those things, low-carbohydrate vegetables. They can do the blueberries, apple, grapefruit, which are low-glycemic fruits, if they can keep their blood sugar be maintained below 110. Raw nuts, especially soaked and rinsed, is best because it pre-germinates them and helps them to be better absorbed. Coconut tends to be great for everybody, but let me say that coconut water from a fresh Thai coconut, that can cause the sugar to go up. Again, I'm speaking from my personal experience, but also working with lots and lots of people through this. I've worked with hundreds of people through this process. I find that if I just drink the water from a coconut, even if I eat the coconut meat with it, my sugar goes up. But if I take the coconut water and I do a culturing to it, or I drink it as kefir, then that's fine. It doesn't raise my sugar at all. So that's just my personal experience. Other people have experienced that, but a lot of people get their sugars raised on coconut water, but coconut in general doesn't tend to do that. Again, we're testing, right? Raw seeds, they're pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, omega-3 rich ones like chia, hemp, flax, those are all good. Caraway seeds, those other kinds of seeds are good too, cardamom seeds. Daily omega-3, of course, your chia, flax, hemp. Algae is another good source of it. Purslane, which is a wild green. Can't get it everywhere, but you can go buy purslane seeds and throw them in your garden. They're considered weeds, so they'll probably grow. So you can encourage people to grow purslane. It's got a little, like a citrusy taste. It's very yummy. Cold water fish and wild game, organic free-range meat, if they're not a vegetarian, they don't have allergies to it, they don't have an aversion to it, some people need that. They can eat that. I wouldn't say unlimited quantities for that because it's heavy. Same thing with the nuts and seeds. It's not unlimited quantities. It's, you know, within reason, enough to keep them full. Foods that they should test and then eat cautiously even if they test okay. And when I say test, I mean testing it out for 5 or 6 hours. I described the glucose tolerance test on the glucose page. And they never get the glucose to exceed 110, but it never also dips below their starting value. So these are the things that they need to be careful about. If they test these foods and they find that this applies, they don't go above 110 and they don't dip below, I still wouldn't do them in large quantities because it may be the quantity that will cause it to do that. And we're really trying to reset these insulin receptors. Low sugar, high water content fruits. I wouldn't go more than one serving a day during the 30 days that you're working with the metabolic reset. Legumes, some people tolerate them, some people don't. Some people need them to keep the sugar steady or to keep their weight on, or if they're athletic and they just need extra volume and they don't want to eat too much in the way of fruit, or they can't eat too much in the way of fruit. Starchy seeds like quinoa and buckwheat, best to avoid for at least the first 2 weeks just to not take chances and then do the testing on it. I find that most people are okay with quinoa, especially if they sprout it. Buckwheat is interesting. Sprouted buckwheat seems to be fine. My husband tried cooked buckwheat, and it shot his sugar up to 160, but he's had some buckwheat crackers, and it didn't seem to do that. So have them differentiate between the sprouted versus the cooked, and that can make a difference too. Same with quinoa. Those are actually considered seeds, but they're starchy seeds versus the fattier seeds like flax and sesame and hemp and all those. Meal planning. You've got all of this in the Before Be Gone menu planner, which you have access to. It's accessible on the side panel of your site where you'll see it there. It'll say Before Be Gone menu planner. You can click there to go to a page where there's a video. That's a page that's put together for people who join the program or who don't join the program and they just buy that option. And you also have it on, I think it's on the Getting Started page. Go through that. Start to experiment with recipes. Modify them to your taste and the tastes of your patients. The Gut Rejuvenator, I like people to have. Green protein drink. They don't have to have all of this, but these are options, and they'll have as much of this as they need to feel satiated, not overstuffed and overfull, and able to make it to the next meal, you know, at least 3 hours, if not 5 hours, ideally. And we'll talk a lot more about timing later on. chia drink, there's recipes for that, green smoothie. With or without fruit, if they test okay for the low glycemic fruit, that's okay. There's a bunch of recipes that are green smoothies without fruit. That's what I've gotten used to. We have these wonderful green smoothies, have a little avocado to make them, give them that creaminess because they don't have the fruit, keeps them from separating, and we put all kinds of great seasonings and things in there. Plenty of recipes for you to choose from, experiment with. You may have your own. You may have your own recipe guides that you can share with. And you may have your own recipes that are higher glycemic that you can modify based on the guidelines in the program to help people and share with people. It's great to give people handouts. It's great to give it. And you want to give credence to you as an authority, so create your own little handouts and your own little ebooks. Breakfast entrees, I have a whole bunch of breakfast entrees in there, like, you know, a quiche and a non-egg quiche type of thing. Greens and chia and coconut are an important thing to start the day with because it helps to keep everything steady. Talked to somebody the other day, or just I think it may have been today, on one of my coaching calls for my energy recharge group, and she said, oh, my God, my sugar cravings are gone ever since I started doing the greens and the chia and the coconut in the morning, and it's so nice to not have the sugar cravings. What we're going to find out is that it's important that they don't start their day with carbohydrates, and I have it on the summary document. And so for meal planning for lunch and dinner, I'm giving you the same options because they can eat the same sorts of stuff. Blended soups, vegetable-rich soups, raw or cooked. Yeah, a lot of people like to do all raw. Some people have gut problems and they can't do all raw. Some people just really are used to and want that heating, or they tend to have a cold constitution according to Chinese medicine and they need that warmth. Healthy fat helps those to be tastier, but also helps move the keep the sugar steady longer. Salad with a dressing, you know, you guys know how to do that, right? Teach people how to do that. A vegetable dish, raw, cooked, or both. Right? You can have a chopped up kale salad. You can have sauteed broccoli, steamed broccoli. Make it rich and full. There's all kinds of wonderful sauces in the recipe guide. You can make up your own. I'm sure you have some of your own recipes that you share with people. It's created in such a way that they feel satiated and they're following the guidelines. A protein source. It's really important to have a protein source because, remember, we said protein is important. So it could be a vegan source. It could be if they eat raw vegan veggie nut pate or dehydrated cracker or a veggie burger or a cooked veggie burger, nuts or seeds in salad or salad dressing, that would provide some protein. Or if they're not vegetarian and they really feel comfortable with the animal stuff, they can put 3 ounces of the lean organic meat with the meal. We're trying not to be dogmatic with people. And you may find that one thing works really well for you and you want to just pass that on. And I did that for a while. It's like, raw, vegan, this is what works. And I found that it doesn't work for everybody. And I had to be really careful about modifying it for specific people. And now some people will say, well, not on all raw. And, you know, because every time I eat salad, I get a gut problem. I work on working on their leaky gut and get them off of raw food for a while. So, but the foods, some people say that the cooked vegetables make their blood sugars go up. So be careful about that. Like if they eat too much cooked and not enough raw, and you can also blend and combine. And that's one way to do it. Most of you got as a bonus some of my recipe guides, I believe. I can't remember. Maybe that was a different program. But it's mostly in the Before We Gone recipe collection. I think that, yes, a bunch of you got as a bonus that you're going to get physical copy in the mail, and that should be coming to you. Scott just said that those are being sent within the next couple of days, so you'll be getting this nice binder in the mail with all those recipes in it. And for those of you who didn't, then you can, you know, print off the recipes that sound good to you. Really, for desserts, when people have that desire for sweets after a meal, it may not go away right away. That's when it's really important to get the chromium and magnesium in them, okay? And it'll take a while, so why not help them satisfy their dessert feeling with the low-glycemic desserts in Before Be Gone? If you look at those recipes, you'll be able to take your own recipes or theirs and help them to turn them into low-glycemic versions. And it just helps to take the edge off. They can make up a batch and keep it in the freezer to curb their cravings. using omega-3 rich things in them, like you could put some hemp seeds in them. You can change the recipes, add a little hemp or chia if they're not getting it elsewhere. There's so many ways. There's just so many ways. It's endless. And just play with it, okay? There's a lot here. The snack attack strategy, I really advise that they go longer between meals. They're not going to do that right away because they're not used to it, right? So what you teach them is if they've got an urge for a snack and it's only been 3 hours since their last meal or less, tune into the sensation. Sometimes it's emotional. Sometimes they're reaching for the food because it's emotional, and you can coach them on how to handle that. You can teach them tapping. You can teach them alternatives. You want them to differentiate hunger from thirst. So what I have them do typically is have them drink about 16 ounces of water or up to 32, and then wait 30 minutes. And if they're still hungry, then it's probably hunger, and they can go ahead and eat something. And then I have a list of blood sugar-friendly foods and part of the B4 Be Gone, and what you'll have on your site is a snack attack strategy document. So here's some of the foods that in order from the least innocuous to the most innocuous to the least, so the ones that are least likely to raise their blood sugar. I give you a recipe for something called green water, which is a handful of greens with a whole lot of water. It just gives them some minerals. They could do green juice, not fruit, but except lemon and lime. They can do water with a tablespoon of green powder, flavored to taste awesome, like mint or lemon or lemongrass or whatever they like. Water with a tablespoon of green powder and a serving of protein powder. Because a lot of times this craving for food is nutrients that they need, not calories. And when you give them these green, nutrient-dense foods, they're good to go. Maybe they need a little bit of omega fat, so get them to try one of the energy drinks, the chia energy drinks. They could put greens and protein powder in that as well. They can do vegetable sticks or do that with a raw dip. They can do an ounce of raw nuts and seeds, or they could do some raw crackers or bread, like a dehydrated flax, chia, buckwheat cracker, something like that, made from the vegetables, nuts, and seeds. So we're looking for nutrient density here, and that's going to help to solve their cravings. And little by little, they will be able to go longer. I have people who just do the spacing between meals initially, and they have tremendous results. You're going to find that some people have a problem with it, and some people don't. Don't make them think they have to go 6 hours between meals, like right from the get-go. Work with them to increase that gradually. So as far as the timing of meals, there's no snacking. If they're going to do the snack, they go through the snack attack strategy. It's usually like a mini meal in between, not like sitting at the desk and munching on vegetables all day long. Even that just keeps everything going, keeps the insulin being secreted and affects the whole balance we'll talk about next week. Don't let them get famished either. I remember when I first did my first Before Be Gone program and people were trying to follow it to the letter, and it's like they're trying to go 6 hours on the first day, and they were getting weak and jittery and irritable and having palpitations. No, they've got to phase into that, gradually increase it. So if they typically have to eat every 2 hours, you help them to get to 2.5 hours. Once they're there, you help them to get to 3. You know, as their coach, and if you're working one-on-one with people, you're going to really be able to help them. And I highly recommend, and we talk about the programs, I'll go into more detail, that when you're doing a one-on-one program with people, that you include and incorporate email coaching or quick telephone call coaching, preferably email coaching, where they could say, hey, this is happening, and you can email them back. But you've got to, when you're pricing it, include that amount of time that you're using with them, because it really helps. Because if they have to wait a week or two before they can talk to you again, and they're having problems in between. But when you're creating the program, you want to make sure that you're compensated for that time. And you may not charge as much at the beginning when you're first practicing this, but once you get good at this, you're going to be in high demand because people are going to get results. Don't let them eat at night. And we'll talk more about that next week when we talk about the cycles of the hormones. But insulin goes up and growth hormone goes down, leptin goes down, and what they get is they lose the ability to burn fat at night and to detox at night. No carbohydrate breakfast, no high carbohydrate breakfast. The chia seeds, the greens, but if they start their day with like an orange juice and toast, they're going to have food cravings later. It creates a whole spike in leptin prematurely, causes the food cravings. I'll share with you next week all the mechanisms behind that. Eat protein within an hour of waking up. Not everybody has to do this. Some people do better when they skip the morning meal and just do lunch. They do intermittent fasting, but you're going to have to feel them out and see. If there's somebody who says, oh, I just feel so much better if I don't eat in the morning. Still, have them eat something. If they can just do a little bit of green juice, that'll give them some protein, or a handful of you know, chia seeds or hemp seeds or something, or one of the chia beverages or something. But if they do feel better when they go longer, then you can spread it out. And then gradually increase the meal spacing. We'll talk more about that next week. Tracking is critical. Use the charts I've given you. Create your own. Everybody's different. You're going to like mine a little bit maybe. You can use it. If not, make your own up. Just use it as a guideline. You want to keep track of what they're eating, how much they're eating, the preparation, at least initially when you're working with them, at least that first week or two. Test their glucose before and after meals according to the charts I've laid out. Checking their pulse before and after meals can help give you an indication if they have allergy-type problems. Their degree of hunger when they go to eat. Are they like emaciated, starving 10? Or are they just saying, yeah, I'm a little hungry, a 1? Check that out. Have them assess that and help them to really wait until they're feeling really strong hunger but not about to keel over hunger. Stress level and emotional state before they eat, because when you start to see levels of glucose go up, they may not make the connection, but you will as an objective second party looking at their stuff. How is their digestion? How many bowel movements are they having? When are they having them? Aches and pains and anything else that they're experiencing, and they're coming to you like, I really hate this particular symptom. Have them track it with regard to what they're eating. And you can become the detective, the investigator, the sleuth that's able to help them to determine what's causing the problem. So we've covered a lot, and it all comes back to this thing. We're trying to balance this insulin-glucagon dance, so that when they eat, their sugar goes up, the insulin gets in, gets it into their cells, it comes back to normal, they get energized a few hours, 6 hours, 5 hours, 4 hours later, they get hungry again. In between, glucagon comes out and keeps their blood sugar steady. They don't have those drops, even if they have to go 8 hours, 10 hours between meals. And that's it. We're going to be going through this over and over. I've provided you a lot of resources. This is a lot of information. Some of it wasn't new. It was just repetitive. And I'm going to do a lot of repetition and then introduce new stuff. There's going to be a lot of the resources on the page for you, a step-by-step and how to work people through this. I think you've gotten a lot of this. You can watch this over and over again. You have printouts of the slides. Take notes on. And I'm going to open it up for questions. Share with me your experiences and any questions about this. But more about the food stuff, when you go into the site and you start to look at things, you'll probably have more questions about that next week. So this week you might have more questions about part one. And I do want to, I'll take a survey of the people that are on the call anyway to get an idea of, this is a lot of information. Next week I may be like, would you prefer to have this to really absorb this, and next week just to do a straight Q&A call so that you can get caught up, and then the following week we can go into the next levels. The next step is a little bit more complicated because it's the pathways of the balancing everything, and I want to give you the background, but it's really the whole process is pretty straightforward once you get it down. So by a show of hands, if you feel like, wow, you'd really love next week to just be straight Q&A because we really went over this week with a lot of information, then raise your hand with a star 2. And if you're on the web and you prefer that next week be just pure Q&A so that you get plenty of time to absorb all this and don't have to worry about new material and you get to explore it and try it and test it out, star 2 is going to say, yeah, you prefer that rather than getting new information next week. And then if you're on the web, go ahead and type that in to say, yeah, I prefer that. And I'll just go by the majority. And maybe if it's like split 50-50, I may introduce just a little bit of new stuff next week, do mostly Q&A and cases and things like that, and then we'll go on. And you're not going to get shortchanged of any. If you do that next week, then you'll get an extra call. So it would be like a bonus call in the middle. Oftentimes when I do these programs, it is best to like break it up and have that middle call be just pure Q&A, and then we go into more. So if that's what you prefer, go ahead and let me know, and we'll go and answer questions. I'm going to refresh, see what people are saying. A bunch of people say, okay, well, I'll let you know during the week what we're going to do with that. Yeah, a lot of people are saying. And yes, if we do Q&A, everything's taped, so just relax about this. Everything is recorded. I never do anything that I don't record. I even record my team meetings so my people can go back and listen again. I record everything, and you get copies of everything. You'll even will get transcripts of stuff. You'll see some of that coming out as we go along. We're going to be introducing transcripts and recordings from the last time we did this as we go through, and you'll be able to go through those and review those and highlight things, and there won't be a shortage of information. So, yeah, we're always going to record everything. Okay, so I'm going to put down all the hands that were raised. It looks like 60%, no, more than that. 80% of you. There were two people that did not raise their hand about wanting Q&A, but the rest of you said yes. So I'm going to lower the hands. And now if you have a question, raise your hand with a star 2, and I'll address that. And Casey put her hand right back up. Thank you. And I'll go to the Q&A here, and I'll just scroll through this, and then we'll go back. Great, Pam. I'm so glad you're on the call. Talk to you in a while. Okay, I'm just going through. People are just responding to that. A bunch of people got their stuff and tested it. Terry and Lisa and Tracy and Victoria. Yay. Oh, Victoria, there you are. I was thinking the other Lee. We have another Lee. Here's a good one. Eleanor, should you not share a blood glucose meter with your husband? This is a personal choice, okay? I will share what I do, and you make a choice about it. Technically, you should never share needles with anybody else. If you're married to somebody, you're already sharing bodily fluids with them, and, you know, it's kind of like a toothbrush. If you're really adverse to sharing a toothbrush with your husband, then you're not going to want to share the needle part, but you can share the unit. So I would recommend if you are adverse to that and you want to share the meter, just buy an extra lancet or just buy the extra little lancets that you can put into the device and you can share the device. Personally, we just share it. And sometimes we just share needles. At first, we were really careful about that, and we're just not really careful about that. We're not careful, but it's up to you. But yeah, there's no problem with that if it's up to you. But technically, the answer I need to give you is that you're supposed to use a new needle every time you test, and you are supposed to, wipe it off with an alcohol wipe and not share it with anybody. And if you share the lancet, you're supposed to wipe it off with alcohol, change the needle, and they can use it. That's the rule of thumb. I've talked to people that have been in the program, including one who's a PA, physician's assistant, and I was embarrassingly saying, ooh, I haven't changed my needle in a while. She goes, oh, I haven't changed my needle in a month. So I had to laugh, and then we were on a call last week with some of my practitioners, and one person said, oh, I don't think I've ever changed my needle. I didn't know you could. We had to laugh because she's had it for over a year. So I leave my needle in and I use it over and over till it feels like it's dull and then I change it. That's not the party line, right? That's not what I'm supposed to say. What I'm supposed to say is, you know, technically to be safe and to be using clean needle technique, you're changing the lancet every time. You probably are fine with changing it every day and you're not sharing it with anybody else. So your decision, your choice, what you do behind closed doors is your business. But when you're teaching it to people, that's what you need to tell them. Tracy wants to know, is it okay to eat low-sugar fruit on its own? I remember that you mentioning to eat protein with other foods. I sort of ingrained it in my head to eat fruit by itself so it doesn't compete. Yeah, here's the deal with eating the low-sugar fruits. I prefer that you eat low-sugar fruits. the fruits with the greens, like lettuce, celery, that sort of thing, to slow down the absorption and then see how the sugar does in comparison to doing it on its own. And if, as far as protein, when you mix protein and fruit, you can actually get a skewed result, because the studies have shown that the sugar will not go up, but the insulin actually does. So you're going to find the chart that I'm giving you to be quite valuable to look up to see how the tests have shown when you eat, say, a protein that causes the glucose not to go up. And also the studies have found is that when you eat fat with fruit, it will tend to slow down the absorption of the sugar but raise the insulin. So those are things to be aware of. Eleanor says, when will B4B Gone start? I want to tell my client who will be going through the program with me. What we will be doing, for those of you who qualified for having one of your clients go through the program with you, is we are going to be sending you a form where you're going to have your client fill out, so we have them in our database so they get the emails and stuff and they get access to the site, because it's by password only. And so we're going to actually, it's going to start at the beginning of October, and we'll have the exact dates and the schedule out very shortly. Beth says, you take care of yourself, we are fine, do what you have to. That was in regard to my question about, hey, I'm having surgery on my broken arm next week and I don't know where I'm at. I personally prefer that we just have a Q&A, and since most of you prefer that, I think that's what we're going to do. We'll give you just a Q&A, and then the following week we'll be going through and doing the module, the part three, which is really a lot of good stuff on stress and timing and the other pieces, stress, timing, and sleep. And they're big pieces. And I would prefer next week that I don't have to prepare any new materials for you. Not that it's new, it's there, but that I'm going to just kind of open it up for your questions and, you know, make sure everybody's on track. And then that what that will do is have us have one extra call at the other end of it, which will be good, because maybe we'll even do that a little bit further along when you've been in Before Be Gone for a little while and see how I do it. Then we can talk about how you can put together your program. So I think it'll work out for the best to just do a Q&A next week. Tracy says she doesn't recommend cashews because of the sugar content. Should she be concerned with this? If you think that I haven't found the cashews raise my blood sugar, and especially when I culture them and make cashew yogurt. But you'll need to test it with people and see. Eleanor says, is Before Be Gone a 30-day program? Here's what Before Be Gone is actually, we have five modules in Before Be Gone, and we present the modules so people get what they're supposed to be doing. And as we're presenting the modules, we're helping them to incorporate little by little, and then we do a 30-day metabolic reset. Usually we do that after we've presented the third, maybe the fourth module. It depends on the timing. And this time we're setting it up so that the 30-day period ends about a week before Thanksgiving. So that'll give them that 30-day reset. You'll get all the details of what that means and that 30-day reset period, but they've had the information. So technically it works out to be about a two-month, probably a nine-week process between the bonus calls we had at the end and all that. So I think it starts beginning of October, ends right around Thanksgiving. So, I mean, technically it starts the last week in September, which is like the getting started preview call. So there's really, I think there's about 10 calls with Before Be Gone. So a lot. You're going to get tired of me by the end of November. You have had probably 15 calls with me along the way. So you get plenty of time to pick my brain. Gina has a question about magnesium, but I don't see the question. So if you want to put that back in, Gina, that'll be great. Tracy says, I suggest the client eat 2 to 3 Brazil nuts for selenium. How many pumpkin seeds to get all the daily necessary zinc? Tracy, it's pretty impossible for them to eat enough pumpkin seeds to get the entire zinc requirement made. I'll give you a chart that's a list of foods and sorted by zinc content. And there's a lot of spices that they can include, and there's a lot of other foods other than pumpkin seeds. Brazil nuts are kind of rare in that they can just eat a few of them and get their full requirement. I'll take two more questions here, and then I'm going to go to the people that have called in. questions? I think two. Let me see how many there are. Marla, can you give me the actual name of the group on Facebook so I can look? The link isn't working for me. I don't know the name of the actual group, and I don't know how to search for it on Facebook because I'm kind of a Facebook dummy. If you go into the website and click on the link that says resources or support, the link there should work. I'm not sure if you're using the one in the slides or there. I may have made a mistake in the slides. That's quite possible. And if not, we'll make sure that you get that. Be sure and shoot an email to you've got your email right here. So if let me know by the end of the call if you still haven't gotten in, and I'll find that and we'll send you the direct link. I just don't know. It's just not my forte. Tracy, I noticed that you listed cruciferous. What if somebody has thyroid, and in particular hypothyroid? Do these veggies create goitrogens? I would say go listen to my radio show from last week where I talked about the thyroid and goitrogens. People do not have to avoid cruciferous if they have thyroid problems. It's like raw cruciferous in excess in some people can create a problem with thyroid, and I talk in detail about that. I don't think they need to avoid. I don't think anybody should avoid cruciferous vegetables because they're too good unless they absolutely overtly get problems from it. Very few people have to avoid it. Gina says, I thought cacao has lots of magnesium. It does indeed. That's why I think it's a good food for people who don't have don't do too much of it and have overstimulated adrenals. That's one of the problems. Have you seen any thyroid problems with eating a lot of raw cruciferous? No, I haven't. And again, I would highly recommend you go listen to my radio show. I get this question on almost every call. I laughed about it because when my assistant said to me, why don't we do a call on or a radio show on the thyroid goitrogen? A lot of people have questions about that. I would say almost every call I do, people ask about that, and I give my answer. There's also a blog post about it. So I'd go read about it. I don't want to go into the half hour of depth that I went into there, but there are situations where some people have a problem and some people don't, and there's ways to diffuse it by eating iodine-containing foods with it, like kelp, and then some people do. I've had a couple of people who said they get cold if they drink kale in their smoothie every day. I'm like, well, don't drink kale in your smoothie every day. Rotate it. Gino wants to know about sprouted legumes, and again, it's a test one, because for some folks, when you sprout, it actually breaks down the proteins and the carbs into smaller units, so it may actually have more available carb than the full-blown cooked ones. So, again, test, right? Anything with legumes, they need to test. Eleanor wants to know, when will we get a receipt? That way we'll receive all the bonus materials, because we signed up before midnight during the kickoff call. I've not received it yet. Scott's working on that, and he's gonna, and I'll have him send an email to everybody that gets the bonuses. And we'll take care of that. Okay, I'm gonna go and see whose questions have come up here, and then I'll switch back. And Casey.
Hi, I'm here. Hi. Can you hear me? I'm sorry, I'm in kind of a noisy area right
That's
now.
That's okay, so I can hear you.
My phone's also about to die, but I wanted to tell you, ask you about the blood sugar balancer from Health Force Nutritionals, how much of that to take. And
I would go by their recommendations. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it's like 2 or 3 capsules with a meal, and
okay.
You do it with a meal or about a half hour before a meal to help to slow down the absorption.
Okay. Second is, I can so resonate with a lot of the things that you're saying to do, but that you don't personally do, like sleep and you forget to take supplements and you're not consistent and all of these different things. I can so relate to those. So, and then finally, I wanted to share with you that while you're recuperating from your surgery and your arm injury, that Dragon software will transcribe you can just speak and will type it for you.
You know, a lot of people have recommended that, and I had an old version that didn't work real well, and it was gobbledygook, but I'm totally willing and ready to be doing that, because I'm going to be, typing with one hand is not very efficient. So
right.
Thank you
it's
for reminding
better.
Me. Probably, I think the new versions are probably better.
And typing with one hand is easier to correct stuff. You don't have to, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. You're right. Once it's out there, I can use the one hand to use the mouse and just
edit.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
So,
thank
anyway,
you so much.
Wishing you a speedy recovery. I'm sorry, because I know that's got to be so frustrating with not wanting to have surgery, but recognizing that's the Western medicine benefit. So
that's
anyway.
One of the places that they're great, right? They're super good at trauma. These guys that just he's a hand and arm man, and that's all he does. So he knows exactly what to do to my arm, and I can try to wish it back into place. And if it was just a broken bone and I, just there's a big space between it, I might be just, doing a lot of energy work. But the bone is, way far away from home. And I don't want to risk long-term disability by saying
nope,
I'm going to try natural medicine. This is the place where they work. And the Western medicine doesn't have a clue onto how to get people to balance their blood sugars in reverse and prevent diabetes. I'll be perfectly frank there. That's why I teach this stuff. But they are awesome at sewing things back on and moving things back in place.
Can they do your procedure arthroscopically?
No, unfortunately not. I asked about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to work on how to do it with the minimum amount of anesthetic and stuff. Can they do it with just a local without putting me out? And I'm working with that. I've been trying to go back and forth talking to a what do they call those guys? Anesthesiologist, right? So I'm hoping that I get some response on that so I can at least say, these are the drugs I want. This is how much I want. I don't want any more than this, that kind of thing. Because I'm not a wimp. I mean, I've been walking around with an arm that is, severely broken. And when the orthopedic looked at me, she goes, do you have a really high pain tolerance? Because that's a really severe fracture, and you've been walking around with it for a month. So, I don't need – I do root canal – well, I don't do root canals, but I do dental stuff without Novocaine. So,
I had stitches in my head from a pretty serious scalp laceration when a trunk hit me on the head, and I had no anesthesia. I chose that because animal testing and stuff, I don't want to do it. But it's I know where you are, and I just want to send love to you because that's a hard thing. I will tell you, hypnotherapy might help with the pain.
Let me have an acupuncturist and a hypnotherapist in the surgery room with me so that I can get, that kind of thing to get out of. And they're kind of, it's Western medicine, and it's kind of hard to get them the value of that. But, fortunately, it's not a hospital, so I don't have to be. And I said that to the doctor. He said, oh, God, no, I would never put anybody in a hospital for something like this. I want people far away from hospitals unless they have to be there. And I went, oh, good, He gets it. Go in for an arm surgery and end up with pneumonia. So
I also saw that you've postponed the November gathering. And in January, I'm going to be out of the country for a good part. I'm going to be in Houston one weekend, so I'm close to Austin.
Will you be in Houston?
I'll be in Houston from the 10th to the 12th for my mom's 80th birthday.
Will you be tied up the whole time for her birthday? Because that's the weekend we're trying to get.
That's the weekend.
The 10th.
The 10th is a Friday, so her birthday is actually Saturday the 11th. So if we were done on Friday in time for me to drive to Houston, I could do that. Is it just a one day?
No, it's 3 days, but you can come for as much as you want, and, it would be
good
to have you there, so.
Well, I'd rather, I wouldn't want to miss the,
we'll be doing it once a year, and next year we'll probably do it in November like we planned because that's really works better for my schedule. But we will do it. I just couldn't do it. I just sat there with how am I going to get this thing together? And the universe was giving me the message. The hotel was giving us a hard time. It was getting to be like, are we going to finalize this so I could tell people the dates? And it's like now I only have 2 months. Part of that time I'm going to be laid up with this injury. I just finally had to say, no, I just can't do it. So
exactly. And that makes sense to me. Maybe you can look at the weekend before, and I could just come in that much earlier and do the whole thing with you and then go to Houston. But, I don't want
to
make this
all about me. Because I put it out to them that that's the ideal weekend. The weekend before is right after New Year's, but that might not be a bad idea. So we'll look at that, and we'll try our best. It's going to be heartbreaking because this person can't make it this day and that person can't make it this day. And Yeah.
So,
but
anyway,
to
thank you. And
everyone,
thank
you.
Move on to the next person. I'm sorry to take up so much time. But anyway, sending you lots of love for your procedure.
Thank you, Casey. Patricia.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. I just bought the A1C kit and the blood sugar, so I'm going to start the program. But how do you use the A1C? You do it just once because they say...
You do it once every 120 days.
Yeah.
The soonest you should do it would be 3 months, but preferably 4. So you take a note of it, how it is at the beginning. I highly recommend everybody get a sense of it at the beginning, and then after 3 to 4 months, you do it again. So, it won't change much because it's measuring the red blood cells, and they have a lifespan of about 120. So you will see some changes over the course of that, but to see a complete turnaround, it's 3 to 4 months.
It's 3 or 4 months. Okay.
Yeah.
And I should do it right now.
Now, make a note of it, chart it down so that you have it, and then, and again, three months to 4 months, you can do it again and see if it's progressed.
Okay.
Okay.
So you said that, a bad night of sleep can influence the insulin resistance, but do you think the insulin resistance could be related to insomnia?
You mean, can it be caused by insomnia, or can it cause insomnia?
Could it cause insomnia?
Well, see, if your blood sugars are out of whack and you're going to bed either with too high a blood sugar or you have drops in the middle of the night in your blood sugar because of the timing of the meals and all that, the insulin resistance can cause insomnia, cause you not to be able to sleep as well. But insomnia can cause insulin resistance, and also not going to bed on time, getting to bed after midnight, getting too late, all that.
Mm-hmm. That I got that. Also, because I'm doing anti-aging program, how is insulin resistance linked to aging?
How is it linked to aging?
Yeah.
Well, you'll tend, if you keep up the same habits, you're going to tend to get more and more insulin resistant as you age, just because it's longer and longer. It's estimated, I don't have the exact numbers, I think I mentioned it in the kickoff call, but it's something like 60% of all people over the age of 60 have multiple parameters for the insulin resistance. So it definitely increases with age, as all things do, not purely from the standpoint of age, but through the standpoint of wear and tear. And
I just want to know if it has an influence on the wear and tears and, aging prematurely.
Well, yeah, and insulin resistance. If you have insulin resistance, like for me, I get, I'm concerned that I have had this insulin resistance probably for a very long time. I just started testing my sugars. And I've been on a really good diet. I just haven't been watching the sugars for the last 27, 28 years. But whenever the sugar goes up and the insulin goes up, it's causing the stiffening of your blood cell, your blood vessels. So it's causing, increased cardiovascular risk and more oxidation and inflammation and all that.
Okay, got it.
Got it. Great
and,
question.
And just one more question. On your drink in the morning when you have your green protein shake, the raw organic protein plus the green powder, can you add anything to it? Or it just has to be like this?
Oh, you add anything like flavoring? You can put whatever you want. You can put cinnamon, you can put cacao, you can put
Pepsin
oil, almond extract, vanilla, whatever you want to make it taste good.
I'm picking the Dr. Cool's powder, and it's just like, it's very hard in the morning.
Yeah, and some of them are bad, and some of them are not bad. There's one that's from Health Force that's called Magic Mint, I think, that I love. And then there's Ormus Greens that has a nice flavor, and Greens First that has a nice flavor. Most of them I just have my peppermint oil or my orange oil or whatever, and I add it to it, or vanilla. Make it taste good.
Yeah, and if I will understand, when we're going to go into the Big On program, that will be in parallel to the insulin resistance program, right? So we're going to have different coaching call with you.
for the, which one?
Before Begone.
Oh, Before Begone. Originally, we had this set up so that these calls ended and then the Before Begone start. Because we're going to add that extra next week being just a Q&A call, it'll go over, but I think it'll be good because I think that last call that we have scheduled for this program is all about how do you put together a program for yourself, and it might be good for you to kind of be immersed in Before Begone and see how I do it for a group,
and then we'll be able
to talk about how you could put it together. So it actually, you know, the universe works in strange ways. It may just work out that this is the better way to do it.
Yes. Okay, I just wanted to. So I do understand what with the Begone program, we will go until before Thanksgiving, right?
Yes, it will finish before Thanksgiving.
Okay, I just wanted to see time wise, you know, about everything that I'm doing.
Yes, and in fact, what we've included for the Before Begone this time is a bonus call that's the week right before Thanksgiving. It's like, okay, you've just done this reset, there's these big holidays coming up. Now what? How are we going to make it through the holidays, enjoy yourself, and maintain all the wonderful results you've gotten?
Wow, that's great.
So, yeah, a whole bunch of bonuses and things that I'm going to be sharing with people to help them through the holidays.
Powerful. Great.
Okay?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Okay, we have Ka-Wu.
How are we going to make it through the holidays, enjoy yourself, and maintain...
You've got on your
turn
your volume down on the computer.
Oh,
so you can hear me on the.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm going to turn off your thing, Ka. Got your line open, Ka?
Yes. Hello.
Hi. To turn it down. You need to turn your computer volume down.
Let me turn it off, sorry.
Oh, turn it off. Because
okay.
I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My question is that I've been taking the natural calm, and I noticed a lot of plateauing.
What have you been taking?
The natural calm for the
natural calm, yep.
Yes, and I just have a lot more plateauing.
More flatulence?
Yes, so I'm
okay,
wondering,
then
you've
gone past your bowel tolerance, so you need
what
to decrease the amount.
I'm sorry?
You've exceeded your bowel tolerance, so you need to decrease the amount.
Oh. I just took like one teaspoon.
Or you might
get
an irritated bowel, and the citrate form of magnesium is not for you, but you might want to switch to the glycinate form.
I can switch to the glycinate form? Is that the capsule?
Yeah, probably capsules that way. I haven't seen glycinate in powder. Or you might try a combination. But first thing to do is to decrease the amount that you're taking of the calm. Maybe not take so much together. How much are you taking?
I'm taking just one teaspoon at bedtime.
One teaspoon?
But
so go to a
half spoon
at bedtime and
a half spoon. But,
in the
morning. I also take another, like a supplement for the it has calcium and magnesium citrate in it and vitamin D.
Do you take that at bedtime?
Yeah, on the side, like a 4-capsule supplement.
Oh, okay. Then
Intellical.
Don't take both together. Just switch one to the morning and one to the evening.
No, I did. I'm doing that. One for the morning is the supplement, and the evening is the natural calm.
Oh, so
maybe
you,
it's too much.
You're not taking that at the same time. You're not taking the
I'm not taking them at the same time. I just took 4 in the morning.
It's probably too much, and your body's saying nope. I don't need this much.
It's probably too much, yeah. So I don't need the supplements, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. So David Lotcher in Perrine, Florida.
That is Eleanor. Can you hear me?
Eleanor. Hi, Eleanor. Yes.
Hi. Perrine, Florida. Yes, that's me. I actually am looking for some advice.
Okay.
I had the experience twice where I've worked with a client that's been on medication, and we've had some luck, and their blood work improved. And when they went to the doctor and they got the good results from the blood work, the doctor said it was from the medicine that they were on, not from the work that I was doing with them, and they didn't want to reduce the medicine. So this client that I'm going to work with this time, he's on Gempriverol and he's on the Centroid. And I'm just looking for some advice. How do I how do I prevent that from happening? Should I approach his doctor beforehand and get some agreement if we see these kind of blood results? I mean, do you have any suggestions?
Okay, there's a couple of ways you can approach it. Okay, one is look at how long has this person been on this particular level of medication that they're on. Say, okay, you've been on it for this long, and this is where you're at right now. So say they've been on it for 6 months. That medication's not kind of suddenly kick in. It's what you're doing that's making it better, right?
Yeah.
So it's really if their sugars are going too low, then the doctor has to respond and lower the medication, right? So if they're saying, well, now my blood sugars are between 60 and 80, and they say to the doctor, well, 60 and 80 is a bit low, I need to lower it, but if they're still in the abnormal range, like say they're diabetic, they're on this medication, their blood sugars are 220, you work with them and get them down to 120, that's still not in the ideal range. So you just keep doing what you're doing with them and help them further along. And then when it gets down to the normal range, they can take them off the medication.
Yeah,
how do you do right now is to say to the person, look, how long have you been on this? Have a conversation with the doctor. Are you okay with me speaking with your doctor? Because I want to make sure that he's on board or she's on board with lowering your medication if we start to get you the results you need.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, having the conversation ahead of time and getting the blood work documented before we start. Because I'm really dealing with metabolic syndrome here, thinking that insulin resistance might be at the core of it all. So.
Well, it is. If it's metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance is at the core. It always is. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Because he's got no blood work problems with the glucose. It's all with the HDL.
He doesn't have that because he's on medication, right? If he's on glucose-lowering medication, he's not going to have that problem. I mean, he's well-controlled. But if he'd like to get off the medication, I think it's worth – definitely should get the blood work done at the beginning and then have a conversation with the doctor. And if the doctor won't speak to you, but at least write a letter and document everything. This is where his levels were 6 months ago. He showed me this is where he is now. It hasn't changed in 6 months, so he's stable right here. We're looking at getting improvement through his diet, and should they go down from there, if he gets to the point where he'd love to wean off the medication, you know, I'd love to have a conversation with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I said it's hard when you're working with that. The medical, some of them are just not open to it, and others are like, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, but unfortunately, twice it's happened to me where they said, no, you didn't do anything. It's the medicine, so I didn't, you know, get anywhere. But I also have a question on your last call. You know, I asked about the leptin, and it's secreted by the fat cells to tell the body to stop secreting insulin. But I was trying to think about it later, and this is a really silly question, but I just have to get this clear in my head. I would think that once your fat cells filled up and it releases the leptin, that people would never get fat, right? That otherwise, because I thought the way you got fat is your fat cells just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So I'm trying to kind of get that.
Question, and that's exactly the question I had. So it has to do with leptin resistance. So people don't take the signal that says I'm full, right? Don't you see that a lot? They just eat beyond that. They just eat. They have the food cravings, and they eat beyond the signal from the body that they're full. So the body continues to secrete a lot of leptin. And then just like the cells become insulin resistant, the hypothalamus is going, oh, you again, leptin, you know? You know, you're not really, and it doesn't change things. It doesn't shift into that mode anymore. It just turns it off. It downregulates. Pancreas become leptin resistant, and the hypothalamus can become leptin resistant. Really awesome book if you want to learn really a lot about leptin resistance is called leptin, what is it called? Oh, man, it's like the leptin, it's Byron Richards. He's got two books. One is a leptin resistance diet. That doesn't go into as much detail, but it's a good book. But it's leptin. Oh, I don't remember the exact name, but it has leptin in the title, and it's Byron Richards. Really awesome book. Big, thick book with lots of references. And he explains all the mechanisms.
Great. Okay, thank you.
We'll be going into more of that next week. I have charts and, you know, various graphs and things that, not next week, but the week after when we do part 3.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks again. Thanks.
You're so welcome. All right. So I'm going to go back, and thank you all for being here. I know some of you have had to drop off. These calls are going longer than I anticipated. So Tracy said, how do you feel about plant protein from leafy greens in a green smoothie for breakfast? Absolutely. That's on my list. Absolutely. I love getting people to use plant protein greens. I say greens and seeds are your best breakfast proteins. That, in my opinion, and the experience I've had with people is that that's what people respond best with. Let's see. Who do we have? Beth? Thank you for allowing us to print the slides before we got started. I took notes on them. You're very welcome. I try to get them done as soon as I can, but it's been one of those crazy weeks. I spent a lot of time taking care of my own health thing, my arm thing this week, so I didn't get these slides done until about an hour before, and I had to proof them and get them up there, so sorry they weren't there sooner. But anyway, Eleanor says, prefers Q&A next week. Will you tape it? Yes, and if you can't make it, what I'd like you to do is submit your questions in advance. And the way you can do it is best is right on the Instant Health Seminar link. When you get that, just click the link and put them right on here so I do it. I will go back and check the ones that were submitted on the website, but this is the best way. Victoria says, I prefer next week. A lot of people say that. I'd like to ask your opinion of three supplements, lecithin for us in Australia. So, yeah, put those links out there on the ERSPC Facebook. And yeah, put it on the Facebook, and we'll see that. And that way everybody will get their response. That'd be great. Okay, so we just got that. That's okay. Tracy, Mastering Leptin. Thank you, Tracy. I have this thing about book titles, unless I have it sitting in front of me. Mastering Leptin by Byron Richards is the book that I was talking about. Victoria wants to know, can you tell me when to test blood glucose when you eat a certain food to see if it affects your blood sugar? For example, do you test right before and then right after? Yeah, and Victoria, I will give you that, the shortcut version of that now, and I will send you to the website in the part one, the glucose page, and there's a chart that shows tells you exactly the best way. The first few times you have people test, I like to test more frequently. Definitely right before they eat, and then if they're open to doing it right after, that's fine, but that's not usually the best. I usually have them go right before they eat, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and an hour. Seems like a lot, but it gets you, helps you to capture and see when they tend to peak. Then I go to 2 hours. I'm tending to, for myself, go to an hour and a half because I saw some weird stuff there. You might want to have them do an hour and a half and then two. And then in order to see if they have reactive hypoglycemia, which I explain on that, there's amazing resource on that glucose page that explains exactly what it means on the interpretation. But then if you go more than 2 hours, like to three, and the glucose is, it should be pretty much down to the normal level, the starting level at three, and then beyond three, if it goes down below the starting level, significantly, not like 3 or 4 or 5 points, but if it goes down 10, 20 points below that, that's called reactive hypoglycemia, which means that the food they ate caused a very high level of insulin and then caused them to go too low. And those foods should be eliminated too. So you want to eliminate the foods that cause it to go above 110, but also the foods that cause the reactive hypoglycemia where it goes down below the starting level past the 3 hour point. Or sooner. Some people go up and then down really quickly, and that's a more severe reactive hypoglycemia. Marla says, did you know that Microsoft Word has the ability to dictate using a mic? Holy cow, I will look into that. Thank you. I don't know if I have the latest version, but that is a great thing to know without having to get extra software. Thank you. I think, you know, my cell phone, my iPhone also has little Siri on it, and that probably could do it as well. So that's it for the questions. No more questions raised. I will go really quickly to the Ask Dr. Rita Marie on the site and see if anybody sent any questions in there. And get going talking to each other on Facebook. There have been people that are in this program that have been through it before. So they'll be able to help, you know, if you've got some specific questions, some of those guys, some of the people that are in the insulin, pre, the
Energy Recharge Practitioner, the year-long program. They will have be able to help you with questions, and also other people, other practitioners, people who have been doing it longer. Everybody, you can all learn from each other. So share your questions, share your cases. If you have a particular person that you're working with and you're having an issue, share. The Facebook is a real easy way to do it. People, you know, a lot of us go on Facebook anyway a couple of times a day. So thank you all for being here. Thank you for your patience with the technology. I know a lot of people had problems getting into the site. We have been having some issues with our site, and we're working on that. We will be probably shifting to a new host for the site very soon. We will be eventually pulling the practitioner stuff out of the main website, so that will speed up the response for that too. It's just, there's a lot of this stuff behind the scenes that takes time. I appreciate y'all wanting to go, and we're just going to do a Q&A next week. So submit your questions in advance, and that gives you the opportunity to really dig into the part one. Part two should be available, my hope is by the end of tomorrow, and if not by the end of tomorrow, by Monday. If it's only partially done, we'll let you know. We'll put up parts of it tomorrow, and you'll have lots to go on. You might want to watch this and the other presentations we've done a second time, or you can download just the audio portion of it and just listen. That's what I do a lot. I'll watch a recording the first time, and then I just stick it on a CD or on my iPod and listen to it while I'm running or exercising. So thank you all for being here. I'll open up your lines so you can say goodbye to each other. And for those of you on the web, appreciate your questions. And take care, and we'll talk to you in a week. Bye now, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.